Start our presentations. Senator Wigger, you're first in our agenda.
Go to this one. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 4481 is the Minimines proposal. All of us agree, in fact, it's in statute, by 2020. Each child should be ready for K. You're also aware that 50%, it's estimated, of Minnesota students are not ready for K. We have invested a great deal of time and dollars recognizing that we need to have students ready for K, and the consequences of not doing this is very expensive to society and particularly to that student as well. So what should we do? We have a variety of programs right now, daycare, we have early intervention and special needs early on. We have Head Start. We still have 50% of students that aren't ready. And so there was a council that put together recommendations a couple of years ago through legislative recommendations. We had recommendations also that we have an office for early learning and trying to get a better handle on the various programs and services that are provided for young people. And one of the recommendations that has come forward during the past several months, and actually over the past couple of years, but is for Minimines. And that's a coalition of business, nonprofits, others concerned about what can we do to make sure that students are ready for K, particularly students highly at risk. And this proposal looks at targeting 3- and 4-year-olds who are at 185% of poverty in their family. We have those guidelines. And it would provide scholarships. The bill asks for $150 million. We know that's a big ask. But also it's a huge need, and it's a state goal. And we know the cost is even more expensive if we don't invest. So scholarships available to those students that are eligible. And I'm going to have an author's amendment that I have not had a chance to share with various stakeholders. It was based in part on a conference call we had last night. And I thank Ms. Butler for a couple of phone calls last night as well to assist in the drafting. And so a couple of the points that I'm going to refer to, you'll see in an author's amendment within 30 to 45 minutes or so. We want to have money going to students that go into programs that are highly likely to make sure they're going to be ready for K. And that's the bottom line, ready for K. There's various ways to measure that. We don't have a consistent statewide instrument that does that, as I learned, but we do have a number of indicators that will tell you whether a student is proficient. I'll be in the bill. We talk about having a MARS number through the accounting system that the Department of Education has that would be assigned to each student that's in the program so that we can show, we can track the progress so that if a scholarship is issued, that we can track how successful was it. In fact, in the amendment that I'll offer, there'll be incentives, financial, to perform to get that full payment. So overall, the state policy goal is students ready for K. This would invest in high-quality programs, proven programs through research, and particularly through the Parent Aware program, which has a rating system for programs, and you'll get information about that shortly. We have so many people that have worked on the proposal, and there's dozens and dozens of organizations, and we'll acknowledge those during the presentation. So, Madam Chair, those are my introductory remarks, and we're going to get into more of the mechanics of the bill and how it'll work through the Director for Early Learning, how those scholarships would be administered, the eligibility requirements, et cetera. And as I said, we will have an author's amendment as soon as that's available. So with that, I'd like to go to my testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Wigger. Please call your testifiers in the order that you would prefer.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Torres-Ray and Senators, for inviting us to have the opportunity to speak to you today on this very important bill. My name is Ann Mulholland. I'm with the St. Paul Foundation and the Minnesota Community Foundation, but I'm here today on behalf of Mini Minds, which is a broad coalition of cross-sector advocates for our littlest kids. Mini Minds and the bill before you is supported by organizations across the state with a common commitment to prioritizing Minnesota's youngest children as the most pressing need and important investment for Minnesota. Supporting organizations include representatives of the business community, education community from early childhood to K-12, the state's leading philanthropic organizations, and local chapters of national nonprofits. Supporters vary greatly in interest, size, and geographic reach, but common to all is a commitment to working with the public sector, private sector, local communities to align early learning efforts to reach as many young children as possible. Minnesota faces a startling reality. Nearly 50% of children in our state begin kindergarten not fully prepared with the skills necessary to succeed in school. When kids aren't prepared early, it impacts all of us. Minnesota has some of the worst achievement gaps in the nation, and we know those achievement gaps begin early, long before kindergarten. Local and national research finds that kids that start behind are more likely to never catch up. They are more likely to require remedial education, special education, and disruptive discipline. They are more likely to go to jail, and exceptionally less likely to graduate from college, get a job, and become positively contributing member of society. This is not an urban problem. It is not a rural problem. It is a statewide problem impacting every community in Minnesota. The costs to the individual child are detrimental. The costs to society are alarming. A recent report released by Wilder Research finds that each unprepared child costs the state of Minnesota $56,000 over their lifetime. Today, that equates to a total of $860 million per year in unnecessary expenditures. Conversely, we know that when Minnesota's kids have the best possible start, we're better off. That start is quality early child care and education. Quality early child care and education helps all Minnesota's kids and families reduce the burden on taxpayers by ensuring classrooms are filled with kids prepared to learn. Quality early child care and education helps our K-12 education system, reducing the need for expensive remedial education, disruptive discipline, and special education programs. Getting children ready is the first step to improving K-12 education. And quality early child care and education helps the future of Minnesota. When kids start school ready, they are more likely to fill high-demand jobs and contribute to Minnesota's economic prosperity. The time to make a difference is now. Minnesota is an urgent crossroads. It's time to take the next big step for early childhood in Minnesota in order to bring quality and access to the state for low-income kids across Minnesota. We've come a long way in the past 5 years in advancing policy to improve early learning outcomes in Minnesota. The state has created the necessary leadership and infrastructure to advance policy efforts focused on our youngest residents. The governor's leadership, the children's cabinet, the Early Learning Council, the Office of Early Learning. In addition, Race to the Top funding and statewide expansion of Parent Aware have established the foundation for us to focus our attention on a single coordinated agenda. It's time for all of us who are dedicated to ensuring Minnesota's kids have the best possible start to come together to build on the progress of the past and the momentum of the last year to move the needle even further. It is time to address the most critical issue preventing Minnesota kids from being adequately prepared, which is access to quality
Do we need to have the slideshow?
PowerPoint, looks lovely.
Or should we just leave it?
It
just needs to be closer. That just needs to be closer. There we go. That might do the trick. Even closer. Can you put it?
Sorry about that. I was
a
little distraction.
No problem.
Sorry. That's perfect. That'll be great. So the reality is the next thing is access. This past summer, representatives from the funder community, the provider community, the advocate community, the business community, the education community all came together to develop a plan to address Minnesota's access gap. The result is MiniMinds, a statewide campaign to address Minnesota's critical need for increased access to high-quality early care and education opportunities to ensure all children are prepared to succeed in school and life. The campaign focuses on a phased approach to ensure access to quality for children ages 0 to 3rd grade in order to reduce our state's achievement gap. It begins with Senate File 481. The MiniMinds policy agenda aims to achieve this goal through increased public investment in programs proven to adequately prepare children for school and life. The campaign defines quality based on the parent-aware rating system. The initial phase, embodied in the bill before the committee today, focuses on scholarships for 3- and 4-year-olds and their younger siblings living at or below 185% of poverty. This was a purposeful decision to bring access to scale. Phase 2 of the MiniMinds agenda focuses on 0- to 2-year-olds and their families. The campaign now is working to identify effective ways to ensure access to quality care and home visiting programs and services during this critical period of early development and to align with the priorities of the Early Learning Council as they relate to this age group. And the third phase will focus on building the bridge to quality within the K-12 system, focused on K to 3rd grade. The fundamentals of the policy agenda are this. Number one, invest in Minnesota's most vulnerable kids. The campaign focuses on 3- and 4-year-olds at or below 185% of poverty, plus the siblings if attending the same eligible program. Number two, fund based on need and market. The amount of funding per child varies based on eligibility for other funding, quality rating of selected program, and average cost of care by geography. The average scholarship amount is $6,000. Number three, build on existing government investments. Scholarships layer, enhance, and expand existing public funding to enable families to access quality programs. Number four, a range of options for parents. Eligible choices for families include parent-aware-based, school-based programs, Head Start, licensed center-based programs, or licensed family care programs. And number five, grow quality supply statewide. Families are not able to identify rated programs in their area can use scholarships to access parent-aware eligible programs that commit to becoming quality rated. By starting with 3- and 4-year-olds, the campaign strives to address the most effective path to addressing school readiness by bridging the gap between early learning and K-12 and illustrates the fastest return on investment to ensure accountability and to build capacity at the state and provider level for expansion of the funding to other ages. In summary, the scholarship model will help kids, parents, and providers statewide. And finally, we have the leadership and infrastructure in place. But still, nearly half of our five-year-olds aren't fully prepared when they reach kindergarten, dramatically impacting their likelihood of succeeding in school and life, and that's not acceptable. So please join all of us in supporting this bill to ensure every child in Minnesota has the opportunity to have a high-quality early learning experience that prepares them for a lifetime of success. With that, I'll introduce my colleague, Rob Runwald.
Thank you, Ms. Mulholland and Mr. Grunwald.
Great. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Rob Grunwald, economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and today I'm providing some informational background. As an economist at the Fed, I cannot speak for or against any legislation. In doing so, I want to first, I know you have some slides in front of you, and I'll walk through a couple pieces. The first slide I want to show is a chart that looks at our labor force going forward. And this is a chart that motivates myself and economists like Art Rolnick, who's recently retired director of research at the Minneapolis Fed. And what he and I notice, and this is information from, of course, from the state of Minnesota and the demographics of the labor force going forward, is that the size of the labor force going forward over the next few decades is expected to slow. And what we need is to make sure that children who are arriving at school are prepared to succeed, are able to join the workforce, and participate in Minnesota's economy going forward. The next thing I'll do is I'll provide some background about some of the research behind some of the numbers that Ann provided. The next slide shows that research has been able to establish that the first few years of life are very important to the health and development of a child. By the age of four, about 90% of the architecture of a child's brain is formed. There's many connections that are formed during these early years very fast. And those environments in which children grow up help to support healthy connections in the brain, such as at home and in their communities. Children that have support early are likely to arrive at kindergarten prepared to succeed. Those children who are subject to adversity, such as growing up in poverty, any exposure to abuse or neglect, these type of situations can help to put a child at risk to come to kindergarten behind their peers. And where children are at kindergarten are where they tend to stay. Researchers, however, are able to establish that these differences between children from an advantaged environment versus those from disadvantaged environments can be observed as early as 18 months. So the slide I'm showing you here is a research project in which they're able to show that at 18 months, they're beginning to see differences between children who are growing up with parents with college educations relative to children who are growing up in poverty. By the age of three, children who have college-educated parents have twice the vocabulary as children who are growing up in poverty. The other body of research shows that high-quality early childhood programs can have a positive impact, especially for children from more disadvantaged backgrounds. So the next slide shows this cost-benefit analysis from the Perry Preschool Project. The Perry Preschool Project was conducted back as early as the 1960s, and they were able to track the impact of a high-quality two-year program for children from disadvantaged backgrounds relative to a control group. And by the age of 40, they found a number of differences between these two groups that added up to monetary benefits. First of all, children were less likely to require special education. They were more likely as adults to earn more money in the labor force, and they were less likely to commit crime. So we have all of these benefits, positive benefits relative to costs. So the next slide shows that for the Perry Project, there is a 16-to-1 benefit-cost ratio, which is very high. What Art Rolnick and I did at the Federal Reserve Bank is that we calculated the annual interest rate. What is that annual rate of return? We estimate that total return at 18%. Most of the benefit is accruing to the public. We estimate that public return at 16%. We also note that James Heckman, Nobel laureate economist at the University of Chicago, has reanalyzed all this data, shows a 10% return. But finally, this next slide shows the results of three other long-term studies. The Abecedarian Educational Child Care Program, which starts at just a few months old to kindergarten age, a full-day program, shows benefits of 4-to-1. The next is the Chicago Child Parent Center Project, whose lead author, Arthur Reynolds, is studying that project here at the University of Minnesota. Here, a two-year program for 3 and 4-year-old children that includes parent education shows positive benefits of 10 to 1. And finally, different from a place-based program, a home visiting program in which a nurse goes in to counsel an at-risk expectant mother shows benefits of 5 to 1. That's the start of the Nurse Family Partnership Program. So all of these benefits are showing a positive return, and most of the benefits across all of these projects accrue to the non-participants or to the public. Finally, I'm going to finish with this next slide, which shows that more recent research on state-sponsored preschool programs have been able to establish benefits. That is, at least 1 year of preschool across a whole host of programs that are offered by states around the country have been able to establish positive benefits on emerging literacy and problem solving, and even social emotional skills. Then I'll wrap up here. The lessons learned from research, key themes here are the importance of investing in quality, well-trained teachers, and also using a research-backed curriculum, involving parents as children's first and primary teachers, starting early, and reaching children who are most at risk. Here we'll achieve the highest positive return with prevention dollars early in early childhood education instead of more expensive dollars later in remedial education. And then finally, bringing this research to scale. Based on our measures of the number of children who are at 185% of poverty and below in Minnesota, that less than a third of these children will have an opportunity to enter a high-quality early education program in the upcoming year. Before I turn it over to Erica, just a couple comments. I know that I received a couple questions in advance. One is the amount of dollars in this program relative to a $4,000 scholarship. And we note that in this bill, the dollar amounts are priced at the level of quality, the cost of quality, in order to provide the continuity of care for a high-quality program, either half-day or full-day. And $4,000 is certainly helpful, can help to bridge a gap, can help to make sure that a child, let's say, if you add that with a child care subsidy, is able to go to a high-quality full-day program. However, it's not going to provide the strength of the continuity of services that we'll find in this bill. So with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cronwell.
Good morning. My name is Erica Moss. I'm the Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness. My organization, commonly referred to as PASSER, has its roots in a long history of business involvement in early learning and descends directly from the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, or MELF as it was known. MELF sunsetted at the end of 2011 after investing 5 years and $20 million in private money to explore the ways of bringing to scale the kinds of returns highlighted by Rob Grunwald just a moment ago. As heiress of MELF's approximately 2-foot-thick stack of research reports, I'm here today to tell you a little bit about the findings. But first, it's important to note where MELF started, and Rob left us off in a good place. The basic facts where MELF started: nearly 50% of Minnesota kids are unprepared for kindergarten, and too many never catch up. About 3/4 of Minnesota kids have all parents in their home working, so they're in some kind of setting away from their parents during the day. Number 3, as Rob mentioned, can't say it enough, quality matters. And number 4, return on investment is highest for targeted investments that connect children at risk for not being ready with high-quality programming. In the end, MELF invested $20 million in applied research to develop a scalable approach for addressing the givens I just listed. Basically, improve quality for all kids while linking the kids who need it most to the highest quality program and do it cost-effectively. The bulk of the investment was made in 2 key pilots, a project to test the Parent Aware ratings, which is a 1-to-4-star system for giving parents information about the quality of providers in their area, and early learning scholarships as a mechanism that gives low-income parents access to programs that can prove via their ratings quality. For those new to this model, imagine the higher education system with its many providers, public, private, et cetera, and the scholarships provided to students to help them attend those programs. What I'm talking about is an early learning counterpart with scholarships to help children attend an array of providers, centers, home-based, school-based, Head Start, but better, because it doesn't just make scholarships available. It gives parents information about the quality of providers through ratings and gives that information to all parents at all income levels statewide. I want to pause here and make clear this isn't a new standalone program that we're talking about. The way that I think about it is about bringing structure and organization to the existing system. Parent Aware works with, as I mentioned, centers, homes, Head Start, private preschool, public preschool, charter preschool, a wide array of providers, and scholarships do too. So we're talking about organizing existing investments into a more coordinated and cost-effective system. A little bit more in-depth on the ratings. Through a pilot, MELF found the Parent Aware ratings to be an especially effective and efficient reform tool. They offer a simple-to-use 1-4-star system for helping parents find the early care and education providers in their community using the best practices for preparing children for kindergarten. The ratings are based on rewards, not regulation. Participation by providers is voluntary, and providers who volunteer are rewarded with access to parent-aware quality coaches and grants to help them implement best practices, the business of parents using ratings in their shopping, including those shopping with scholarships, and marketing support. While nearly all other states now use similar systems, Parent Aware represents the most market-based approach in the nation. Overall, MELF found the Parent Aware ratings to be a remarkably versatile reform tool. For parents, Parent Aware serves as a consumer reports-type resource to better inform their childcare shopping. For providers, the rating system provides a clear quality improvement roadmap and a host of rewards. For taxpayers, the ratings offer a warranty to ensure that tax dollars flow to providers who are using school readiness best practices. In addition to the ratings, MELF piloted a scholarship program, much like the one before you today. Scholarships were initially designed to help low-income children access high-quality early care and education, but the scholarships were different than traditional government programs in fundamental ways. The scholarships piloted were streamlined, involving less paperwork for parents and providers. They were portable. Families could take the scholarship from provider to provider without losing eligibility. They were empowering. Families viewed the funds as a scholarship for early learning, not a traditional government assistance program. And finally, they were focused on providing access to quality because the scholarships could only be used with providers who had strong parent-aware ratings. So, again, I'd like to just pause and help you see this how I see it. Think about the ratings and scholarships as a framework for organizing and coordinating investment. What's happening increasingly with state investment through Race to the Top and other initiatives is that provider supports like training, quality improvement, et cetera, are increasingly being lined up with Parent Aware. Scholarships do something similar with investment in helping children access programs. State dollars flowing through scholarships to child care centers or homes, school-based pre-kindergarten programs, and Head Start is all also aligned with the Parent Aware ratings. This supports our diverse market of providers, much like higher education scholarships do. I'm going to just briefly highlight the most significant findings from the MELF pilot. I believe you have some research summaries in your packet. The first is low-income children moved into proven quality. So coupling Parent Aware and scholarships greatly increased low-income kids' access to high-quality programs. Prior to receiving a scholarship, a majority of children, 57%, were in unlicensed settings. After receiving a scholarship, 100% were in Parent Aware-rated 3- or 4-star programs. A couple of notes on the characteristics of those children. Many were English language learners. A little over half of the families had a primary home language of English, with Hmong and Karen being the next most commonly spoken languages at home. Children who participated in the scholarship program were ethnically diverse. On the application forms, of the parents who identified their children, 18% were Asian and 21% were African American. And about 3/4 of the families, 72%, had household income below 100% of poverty. So very low income families found these scholarships useful. A variety of providers also participated. In the biggest scholarship test to date, 20% of the scholarships went to public pre-kindergarten programs, 28% to Head Start, and the remaining 52% to Parent Aware rated 3- and 4-star programs, centers, and preschools. Next, ratings improved quality. The number of rated providers increased steadily over the course of the pilot, and the majority of providers moved up at least 1 star when seeking a rating for the second time. It's worth noting here that family child care providers, child care homes, moved up 2 stars on average. Among child care providers who volunteered to be rated, 92% said that Parent Aware program improved their quality. all types of programs, including smaller licensed home-based providers, proved able to achieve high ratings, 3 and 4 stars. At least 24,000 Minnesota children, both low-income and non-low-income, were served in programs committed to quality as demonstrated by their parent aware rating during the pilot. This is a key benefit of this model. It's a very systemic model. In the pilot, only 650 children had scholarships, but 24,000 benefited from the parent aware ratings. It's a classic rising tide lifts all boats. And this is especially important. We keep talking about nearly 50% of the kids are not ready for kindergarten. These are not all low-income kids who fall into that group of not being ready. And most of those kids are in a setting away from their parents during the day. So it's very important, and a key sort of cost-effective component of this model is that it reaches all those kids where they are during the day. Finally, and most importantly, children in rated programs made strong gains. Children in settings with parent-aware ratings showed significant gains in kindergarten readiness measures such as expressive and receptive vocabulary, phonological awareness, print knowledge, and social competence. In terms of language and literacy measures, low-income children in rated programs made greater gains than the full sample of children. So the parent-aware plus scholarship model has been tested and proved successful in a pilot. In addition, the model enjoys a wide range of public support. A 2010 statewide survey found that 96% of Minnesotans agreed parents should have access to the best available information to help them find the best places for preparing children for kindergarten. That's what the ratings do. And 73% of Minnesotans statewide agreed that we should only allow tax dollars to be spent on early childhood education providers who have proven they are effective in preparing children for kindergarten. I'll close with a quick overview of where we are today with implementation of the model. Parent Aware is currently being expanded statewide and will be in every county by 2015. The 2010 legislature appropriated resources to create a state-funded scholarship program. Those scholarships are available on a limited basis, but statewide. So in several communities statewide, there are small numbers of these scholarships. And to the best of my knowledge, there are waiting lists everywhere where those scholarships are now, and that didn't take very long to happen. So in the areas like in St. Paul where the pilot had been and where there was a supply of rated programs, the scholarships were used up in, I think, about 5 weeks.
Ms. Mass, I just need to make the author aware of the fact that we have an hour for each bill, and you have used 45 minutes in your presentation, and you have 7 amendments that we need to entertain on this bill. So you need to be aware you have 15 minutes to do that. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, I must ask again, we seem to have a recurring problem in this committee that we bring a bill in, it's jammed through in an hour, and then I've tried to ask questions of several people in the past few weeks. They get offended that I'm asking a question. They won't answer how much something costs. And now we have this piece of legislation that will fundamentally transform early childhood education in the state. We got 15 minutes? I think that's an injustice to the people here again and to the citizens of this state. We need more time than this.
Senator Chamberlain, a couple of issues. I don't recall people being offended with your questions. I think that is...
I do, Madam Chair.
If you let me talk. And number two, these will not fundamentally change early childhood. Probably the next one will change fundamentally early childhood. This is just adding $4 million to $700 million that we spend in early childhood education. And third, as you recall, we have had to suspend our hearings in this committee because we have session. We discussed, the exchange program, the exchange bill for 11 and a half hours, 96 amendments that we had to entertain. I canceled my meeting, so I had to move. I have to move now, and I think an hour is sufficient. So I'm going to try to move as fast as I can.
If we keep talking,
we have less time to do this.
Well, I will make my constituents and the citizens of this state aware of the fact that we're jamming through this major piece of legislation in these committees with under an hour of time to discuss it. This is really not the way we should be doing it.
I'm trying my best, Senator. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, very respectfully, and I understand we're in a difficult situation with this committee and the time slot that we're in. I do not feel like this bill can be heard with the policy ramifications that are included in 15 minutes or less, especially in light of the fact that we have 7 amendments. We are a deliberative body, Madam Chair, and the exchange bill was a, I think we all would agree, was a very important issue for the state. And, you know, we have one party control of the three levers of government. The only thing that we have as a minority is the ability to make public comments on the record so that our constituents and even constituents in Democrat districts that may agree with us have their voices heard. I do not feel like this, and many of the people in this room know that I'm very receptive to this conversation around high quality early childhood, but this bill cannot be heard in the next 15 minutes. I would implore you to make more time for it either today or at a later date. Thank you.
Thank you, members. Please proceed with your testimony.
I'll conclude my testimony, Madam Chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity today. My name is Mary Kozak, and I'm a program officer at the Blandin Foundation in Grand Rapids. And I've been working with all of the early childhood providers in Itasca County since November of 1998, when I first started working with Blandin. I oversee one of our largest local grants. It's a grant to Itasca Area Schools Collaborative for the Invest Early Project. And we had been building a strong base of support with all of the early education providers for more than 5 years before we embarked on the Invest Early Project. And all of the studies that Rob told you about, we had a task force that took a look at all of those. And then what we did was we took the best components of all of them and put them into our Invest Early Project. It's now serving over 400 low-income children, many of them with several risk factors. And results of our project continue to show positive trends in child and family outcomes, as well as positive changes to the early childhood system in our county. By year five, Invest Early kids were entering kindergarten equally prepared to succeed in school as their higher income peers. And now, in year eight, the Invest Early cohorts that passed through third grade and took the MCA 2 tests in math and reading, they have shown that they're able to continue this progress, and they've outperformed a comparison group of children without the Invest Early experience. And I think it was all of this experience that we had that prompted us, Itasca County, to be selected as one of the four transformation zones in the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant. And it meant that our families could access the scholarships, very similar to what we're talking about here today. We were excited about this because that we knew our Blandin dollars weren't enough to support all the kids that needed it. So what I'm here today to do is to share with you just a few stories of some of the kids that have benefited. There's a family where they have both parents work full time. They have two kids, ages 2 and 5. The 2-year-old has medical issues, so they have to travel to the Mayo Clinic quite a bit. The family didn't qualify for Head Start, but they did qualify for the scholarships. And you can imagine how happy they are now when they realize that their child care expenses were going to be taken care of. Now both children can go to their provider, and she has a teaching degree. She's a 4-star rated provider. And the kids can both go during the summer months, because before, the parents couldn't afford to send both kids, so they had to, you know, have one go to multiple arrangements, whatever would work, and then the other child went to childcare. So now both of them are able to. Another provider shared a story about two grandparents raising their daughter's kids. They really wanted to stick with their 3-star provider, and in fact, that had been one of their daughter's wishes before she died. The grandmother was going to have to retire early in order to care for the children until she learned of the scholarships. Now, with child care being taken care of, the provider notes not only the big difference in the kids, but also in the grandparents. They're not quite as stressed out and sharp with the kids as they had been earlier. And I also want to let you know that it's not just the family child care providers that are benefiting. Our local YMCA center-based program was also able to access the scholarships. When I asked the center director how it was going, because 20 of her kids qualified for them, she said that the parents were overjoyed and very grateful. She kept using the word relief over and over again, because now their future child care expenses are going to be taken care of, and they're able to concentrate again on their children. They have relief at their bills not climbing higher and higher. How about Head Start and school-based programming? While scholarships allowed 25 preschool children to be taken off the waiting list when a classroom was opened up at the local elementary school. And Head Start, they were able to take a half-day class and turn it into a full-day program for the 17 kids needing it, again, through the use of these scholarships. Other pluses? The validation that the providers feel upon earning their star ratings. Some providers are surprised to discover they actually need additional training. One provider told me, I've been in this for more than 25 years. You know, what do I need? But she took a class on nutrition, and she was gushing over everything that she had learned. Another unexpected consequence, there's the story of the mother who can now let her son, who will turn 5 this summer, stay in daycare this fall. Her provider said that he wasn't yet ready for kindergarten, and she was going to send him anyway because she couldn't afford to keep him in daycare and her home was in foreclosure. Now, receiving the scholarship, she's able to give him that extra year to learn and mature rather than forcing him into kindergarten. So in closing, I'd just like to express some thoughts to the authors of the bill. You really have listened to the needs of many. And we in the rural Minnesota communities are grateful for the consideration you have given to our families in need of a hand up. Your bill will have a lasting impact on thousands of families, and it's an investment you will never regret. When I testified in front of two House committees, I asked them, you know, what are we waiting for? What's holding us back? Minnesota is so ready. There's 80-plus communities throughout Minnesota that have early childhood coalitions through the help of the Minnesota Initiative Foundations and the McKnight Foundation. They are primed. They are ready to move with support of this bill. You've heard about the 100 or so agencies, organizations that are behind this Mini Minds campaign. I mean, everybody is so much in favor of this. So I firmly believe now is the time. I really think this is the year. So to borrow a phrase from Nike, let's do it.
Madam Chair, there are many others that would like to testify. We don't have enough time now. There's going to be several stops for the journey of this bill if it progresses. And I'd just like the record to show, and statements can be submitted for those that would like to. I'd like to offer the A5 author's amendment.
Thank you. Senator Wigert, let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Just a second, Senator. Let me get the...
And Madam
you
Chair,
the A2 amendment, Senator?
Yeah, it's the A5.
A5.
There was an A2, but this includes some additional information. And what I'd like to do is just highlight a couple of items in it. It caps the scholarship at $8,000, though there, you know, there could potentially be a waiver if it went higher than that. We're told on average that it actually might be less than that. It depends depending on the needs of that particular child. But I didn't want it to be a blank check. Also, I have a provision that has the scholarship amount, the full amount, payable after verification of results on growth and proficiency. Those would be a couple of the main things. And the also priority would be given to students that would be in a program that's rated 3 or 4 stars. These are programs that are proven, tested. The research is clear. Business nonprofits have said these will work, and the priority would be there. I know there's the need to get further rated programs, and there's a lot being done to do that, but I'd like to put a priority for those programs that are proven and tested. As an author's amendment, this would put it in the form I'd like at this point.
The author moves the A5 amendment. Any questions on that? Senator Clausen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wigert, how did you arrive at the $8,000 figure, please?
Senator Wigert.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, it was less than the amount that I was given at $12,000, $13,000, I was given a variety of different amounts as to what it might cost. $4,000 is what, you know, the governor has in his bill. I came up with $8,000. Just averaged out. It could be refined a little bit more as we go through finance. We want to get as many of these scholarships out to those students that we want to target, but we need to provide a reasonable amount of funds. 8,000 was looked at as more realistic without it being a blank check.
And thank members, you, Senator. Senator Clausen, your question is an important one. I want you to remember that the question before us, the review that we're doing, is really related to the policy aspect of this program and whether or not the policy attached to the distribution makes sense to you. So I just want to make sure that you know that's the policy question for us. So whether or not you think that this is sufficient money, that this money should be available, that the income should be changed, whatever it is related to the provision of funding for these, the dollar assignment, that is the question for Senator Wigert to entertain in his committee. In this committee, all we're doing is making sure that this language that is before you makes sense for the distribution and the responsibility that is assigned to the department to actually do the task. So I want to remind members of that. Any other questions for the author?
Briefly, I change a may to shall. This is on the collection of data. This bill would have to go to the judiciary because of data.
That is correct.
But I feel it's very important that as we collect information, we need to know, is there growth? We want verification that we're going to get a $16 return on a dollar invested. We want to show kids are ready. If we don't have information in the MARS accounting program, it said May, and I want it clear. Just like we have the overall SLED program for longitudinal educational data. If we don't get numbers that we can verify, then it's just anecdotal and not research-based. So
Senator,
that's the purpose for that change.
Let's move this amendment, and I want to remind you that we did have another testifier that did not have a chance to approach the table. So members, on the A5 amendment, any other questions? If not, Senator Wigert moves that we amend Senate File 481 through the A5 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Preacher, our apologies. We move quickly into this. We want to make sure that all the people who call to testify are invited to testify. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to testify, or I guess you'd say in opposition to this bill, and raise some concerns. I know, and also an organization called Education Liberty Watch has similar concerns. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Certainly, we all want to improve the well-being of our children and improve parental choice. However, I'd like to raise some concerns whether the massive increase in funding for preschool programs under this bill, which is proposing to increase spending by over $325 million over the next 3 years, will actually do that. I suggest it won't, and in fact could make matters worse. First, there's no evidence of long-term benefits from these preschool programs. Consider Head Start. There have been major studies done on and reviews of studies on Head Start in 1985 by HHS, in 1997 by the General Accounting Office, and a 2003 study of 2,800 Head Start kids and 43 Head Start programs found no long-term benefits. And most recently, a 2010 study of nearly 5,000 kids in Head Start programs found first graders who had been through Head Start were no better off than similarly situated kids who didn't go through Head Start. And math skills of three-year-olds were actually harmed. Second, there are harms which come from putting kids into preschool programs too early and for too much time. A 2005 study from Stanford and Berkeley looked at data of 14,000 kindergartners from a National Center for Education Statistics study. Their study found harm to young children's social and emotional development. Quote, "We find that attendance in preschool centers, even for short periods of time each week, hinders the rate at which children develop social skills and display the motivation to engage classroom tasks, as reported by their kindergarten teachers. We find that the decrement to social development is not limited to one domain, externalizing or aggressive behavior. Our analysis reveals that this drag on the typical pace of social development is moderate magnitude and extends across all three forms of social-emotional growth. Third, there is no evidence that rating systems will actually improve child outcomes. Here's a quote from the Parent Aware 3-year review by MELF in November of 2010. No definitive patterns of linkages between rating categories program characteristics or proxy scores developed from director and teacher surveys, and child outcomes were identified. On top of that, according to the Parent Aware evaluation, large centers and health and Head Start programs received automatically 4-star ratings. As I already mentioned, the Head Start programs show no benefits and even some negative outcomes. If programs which aren't successful receive 4-star ratings, what does that say about the efficacy of the rating system? Fourth, the rating system and the state money will pull in private and religious daycare programs into the state's controversial one-size-fits-all approach to curriculum and assessments. This happens because to receive a 3- or 4-star rating, recipients of the scholarship must line up their instruction and assessments with the early childhood indicators of progress. What are these standards? Here are a few examples. Begin to develop an aware knowledge and acceptance of own gender and cultural identity. Use play to explore, practice, and understand social roles and relationships. Develop an awareness of self as having certain abilities, characteristics, and preferences. These suggest that they'll be targeting gender and cultural identity for preschool children, family structure, and sexuality issues at very early ages. And finally, this approach of additional state regulation and hence control will reduce access to child care for many middle-class families. How so? By the receipt of tax dollars, payer dollars, it means these preschool and child care centers are considered subsidized for purposes of unionization, and they will be required to adopt the state's curriculum and assessments and other regulations. This means higher costs will be passed along to parents, the consumers of preschool programs. Higher costs means less access. In conclusion, there's a lot of talk about the benefits of early childhood programs. All of the research I've seen suggests the exact opposite. There's no lasting benefit to children, and there are even some negative consequences for children who attend preschool programs. And there are problems with the effect of the QRS rating system. An increased state regulation and control of our preschool and early childhood programs which adopt the rating system. We all want to help children. I don't believe the massive increase in funding for preschool programs, certainly well intended, will do that. In fact, I think it will have the opposite effect. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Preacher. Again, members, we're going to review. I want to make absolutely sure that you know we are reviewing the policy that will implement, if you choose to move this in finance, how we distribute the funding. So the questions and the amendments should be related to the language that has been presented for that purpose and is the pure policy review that we are doing today. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Thank you. The A3 amendment, if you could distribute that, please.
Madam Chair, is it your intent to entertain each of the amendments?
That is correct,
and
Senator.
I might suggest perhaps all the amendments, if the proposers want them distributed now, we'll have it all out.
Thank you.
Take them in order.
Senator, we will do that. I presume you don't have these amendments. You haven't seen them. Okay. Members, I want to remind you, I understand that you are free to do whatever you want because there are no rules about amendments in the Senate, but I would very much appreciate if you could talk to the author so that we can prepare and give you the opportunity perhaps to talk about how to incorporate this language into the bill through the author. So if you could talk to the author in advance, you could certainly help us with the time that is needed to move these bills forward. Senator Nelson, on the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, this is the amendment that we had discussed Thursday regarding looking at the amount of money that we're already spending on the CCAP program and bringing quality into that. In other words, what this amendment does, we understand the importance of quality early childhood. And so what this amendment does is that beginning in July 1 of 2018, those child care dollars that are spent on the child care assistance program, whether it's through MFIP or basic sliding fee, in order to receive those dollars, the provider must participate in the quality rating and improvement system, as described in your bill, Senator Wieger. And then the second part of this amendment simply states that by 2020, they must have a 3 or 4 star rating in order to receive those funds. So this is looking at what you're proposing, but looking at making sure that parents have that choice, that information, and that quality in the, and I believe it's about $200 million that we're spending per year on CCAP at this point, or $400 million for the biennium. And so it's bringing quality to that money that we're already spending. And I believe this is what we visited about on Thursday.
Senator Wieger, on the amendment.
Yes. Madam Chair, the proposed program we have is voluntary. This would be mandatory for the whole CCAP, which is a couple hundred million, and it's my understanding to ramp up to a 3-4 star rating program for, for funding, we'd have to get more testimony. We haven't had anyone from CCAP here, and so and it would also bring this in through Health and Human Service Committee. And for CCAP, for Child Care Assistance Program. So I would like to work on the spirit of this amendment on a different bill, because this gets at the early learning scholarships and the child care assistance. While related, I think if we act on Senator Wicklund's bill for the consolidation of agencies, I think that provides a great opportunity. So I support the spirit, but not in this bill, and would like to work more with her on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wieger. We have discussed this in the Health and Human Services Policy Committee as well, which is, and to your point about the need to have the system ramp up, that is specifically why the timeline is 2018 and 2020. Certainly 5 years should be ample time to ramp up. And I also think it's a matter of responsibility. We really owe it to the people of Minnesota to use the money that we're already using for 3- and 4-year-olds in a quality manner and in a quality initiative. So I think this is, and Senator Wieger, this would validate your bill as far as the importance of early childhood, parent aware, giving parents information. And I would submit that those children who are already served through CCAP, because of financial need in the home, those parents need that information. They need to know what quality ratings their the centers or the homes that their child is attending is. So I think it's a very important amendment, and I also think it's not only good policy, I also think it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. Let's tackle the $400 million we're spending here.
Ms. Hilden, I want you to be very brief, please.
Madam Chair, Nancy Hilden, and I represent Many Minds Coalition. Senator Nelson, your intentions are much appreciated on this amendment. Everyone that has been working on this has the same goal in mind of improving the quality of the care settings that our youngest kids are receiving, and that spans the ages 0 to 5 before they enter the school system. What I would suggest is that this will be the numbers are somewhat arbitrary because we don't know that 2018 is the right year. What I would suggest is that we do have some interest in looking at this, and there is in place the Early Learning Council to come up with a timeline that actually would work. And so with the spirit of this being common amongst everyone to increase the quality, we just want to make sure that working families that need care are not going to be restricted in their ability to actually have care available. And we need to also help these providers ramp up their quality in a fashion that is going to keep them in the system, not kick them out.
Members, any other questions?
Madam Chair, my question isn't to the amendment, so I can wait, okay. I suppose.
Any other questions? On the A3 amendment, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. Members, any other amendments?
Madam Chair, I'm fine with the A6.
Okay, so let's move on that one. Senator, thank you. Let's distribute the A6 amendment. I think we are distributing all the amendments so that we can save a little time if we can.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
The A6 amendment
was. Is that your amendment? Please proceed to present.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wieger, I appreciate that for the members of the committee. The A6 amendment is simply saying that a provider must not use any public funds to pay for union dues. As many of the members of the committee probably know, there's a simultaneous legislative effort to unionize child care providers. This is a simple protection to make sure that we don't commingle our investment here in early childhood with that issue.
Members, any questions on that?
Do I need to move the amendment, Madam Chair?
Mr. Peterson, Senator Peterson, I don't have the amendment, but if you could hold just a second. We have several amendments that are coming in. Thank you. Okay. Senator Weakland?
Just a question for Senator Peterson. Just wondering what would you consider a mechanism to enforce or cause this to be verified?
Senator Peterson.
Well, there's no criminal ramifications in the amendment, so it would just be direction for the entities that are involved in the statute, much like many other policies.
I guess I just would, my concern about it would be that if we ask that this happen, does it become a burden for providers that they have to somehow do some sort of tracking to say, yes, I'm not using any of my public funds to pay for union dues? I guess I'm concerned about adding additional burden for providers on that. But.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund, I would say that once they're responsible for the dollars that are within their control, I would say once the funds are outside of their hands, you know, nobody's going to be able to make that decision, nor should they necessarily. But like I said, members, it's a fairly modest amendment. There is no criminal ramifications for noncompliance with the statute. So it's direction for public and private entities.
The author has agreed to do this. A couple of issues that I'm concerned about. Number one, you know, the entire conversation that belongs in the State Government Committee with respect to Senator Peterson is part of that committee that has had ample conversations about this issue and the issue of funds, which, you know, again, clearly it's our duty to look into the how we use the funding that we will be providing, but we're not talking about funding. But the author has agreed. Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think this kind of is kind of a hybrid. It does entail policy because we're making a policy that you don't want the funds to be directly used for union dues. So I would may suggest adding directly to pay for union dues, because once the monies are in a provider's hands, you know, that's their income commingled with maybe private funds. But to Senator Wicklund's point, it might be harder to track, but it may be more clear to say it in your amendment directly, so we know that you can't directly use the scholarship to pay for union dues, would be my comment.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, members, again, warning on providing language for the use of funding is a sensitive matter. We need to proceed to vote on this amendment, but is Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would oppose this because this is a person's income, and so we're actually directing how they can spend their income. And I just don't see that that's appropriate. It would be like saying they can't spend their income on groceries. I think that's an individual decision they need to make. Thank you.
So let's proceed to vote, members, on the AC6 amendment. Senator Franson?
Madam Chair, I would offer an oral amendment to add directly to the language of Senator Peterson's amendment. So it would read, a provider must not use any public funds to pay directly for union dues.
Madam Chair, I'd accept the oral amendment as a friendly amendment. I think it helps get at the objection that Senator Clausen just stated as well.
Senator Franson, could you expand on your amendment?
Madam Chair, to my earlier point, it just makes it a little bit more clear. It's still, I think Senator Clausen has valid points as well, but I think at least I feel more comfortable having that any public funds or any of the funds that would come from a scholarship can't be used directly to pay union dues. But once the funds become income, I do have that concern that Senator Clausen raised. Right. I just feel more comfortable being a little bit more specific in this language.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, is the chief author, Senator Wiegert, are you okay with this amendment?
Yes.
Did I hear you say?
Okay.
Senator
Madam Chair,
says yes. Yeah, he said yes. Okay, all of those in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A9.
The A9 amendment. On the amendment, Senator.
Madam Chair, Senator Wiegert, this is a very short amendment, and basically it just says that all of our rated programs should comply with the same quality rating criteria. And so that would mean all programs would need to be quality rated on the same playing field. So we would not just approve a program without going through the quality rating measures. And specifically, I'm getting to the testimony regarding, I think, some of our programs currently under your proposal would automatically be granted a 4 stars without actually demonstrating that.
Senator Wiegert, on the A9 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Hilden.
Ms. Hilden, the A9 amendment,
yeah.
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, let's see. So one of the problems with this amendment, again, is that a number of programs are going through an even higher bar accreditation. And what we're basically saying is, and I think that this should appeal to the spirit of what Republicans don't want government to do. You don't want to make businesses jump over this hoop and then jump over this hoop if you can actually show that through the accreditation that you're already doing, that you are meeting the tests of this other set of hoops. So for that reason, again, with that support of this spirit, that you're trying to make sure that everything is quality, I would submit that the accreditation standards that are used are good and help the businesses not have to jump through multiple hoops.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hilden, this is specifically targeted to the fact that currently the Head Start programs, which are according to my understanding, exempt from qualifying for the 4 stars based upon criteria. And I think if we're talking about quality and giving parents choices and making sure that children go to high-quality child care, I think it's incumbent, I think it's very American and very Minnesotan to have a level playing field so that all settings qualify with the same bar. That is not a very Minnesotan way to say that just because you are a certain type of program, you don't have to qualify. I think the criteria should be the same for all settings.
Ms. Orr, could you please introduce yourself and you have a response for Senator Olson.
Yes.
Nelson, excuse me.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Orr. I work for the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services has lead responsibility for implementation of Parent Aware in coordination with the Office of Early Learning. Senator Nelson, accelerated rating applies to accredited programs, Head Start programs, and school-based pre-K programs. And it does require, it recognizes that all of these programs do have quality assurance measures that they already have to meet, so it takes that into account. In addition, they do need to meet a uniform standard having to do with assessment and curricula. So there are two additional criteria that the accelerated programs need to meet in order to qualify for a four-star rating. So there is a consistent set of two additional criteria that all three types of programs have to meet in order to get the rating.
Senator Nassim, I'll be very brief. The one question I would have is that the Senator Wieger's amendment to his bill specifically stated that if there was not a year's growth in a year's time, there would be a 20% reduction in funding. And I want to know if that would apply to Head Start as well. And, Madam Chair, while they're finding that, let me just add one comment. In light of the congressional report on Head Start and the concern that the any gains dissipate by grade three, I think it's incumbent upon Head Start, as well as all programs, to be able to demonstrate their effectiveness. And so I would say even in more so in light of the most current congressional report.
Ms. Hilden, do you have an answer for the amendment, please?
Madam Chair, on the 20% in the amendment, that would apply to anyone that is receiving scholarship. So for a student that's at a Head Start program, they would have to demonstrate that.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator, just kind of Senator Nelson took some of it, but the goal is quality. This is about giving families quality choices, and those quality choices will eventually lead to quality outcomes, and the outcomes being the kids graduate and the achievement gap closes, and they have better academic performance. The measurements are inputs, right? Because I just, if we're going to help families out, you know, I hate to compare it to like buying an automobile, but you don't want to buy an automobile just because it looks nice. You like the outside, you like the way you sit in it, but you always look at the, you know, is this car going to last over 2 years, and is there a warranty? And if there's not, you're not likely to buy it. But we're not giving families that option here. With this bill, we're not doing it. And what this amendment does says everybody's going to be equal, and you have to show us the outcome. You have to qualify at least at the same. I'd like to change the outcome measurements here. I'd like to change the measurements to outcome. But short of that, could we at least make a compromise and say, okay, we won't change it to outcome, but we'll compromise and we'll say all the programs, including Head Start, which has failed numerous for 40 years to serve families and kids, that we can at least go to something like this and let's evaluate all of them on the inputs if we can't change anything else. This is a nice compromise to that. Thank you.
Senator Wieger, it seems like you have a response from someone, but I don't know.
Ms. Moss.
Ms. Moss, please, Madam briefly.
Chair, Erica Moss, Parent Aware for School Readiness. We're a private sector partner in the implementation of Parent Aware, and we're funding, together with United Way, a program evaluation that evaluates outcomes for kids across the programs participating in Parent Aware, so Head Start programs, school-based programs, child care programs, and family child care programs. We're measuring outcomes on a sample of kids, measuring their progress over a year. And that's, you know, that's part of the private sector commitment to this project. We'll be funding that through 2015. And so, Senator Nelson, I understand your concern, but much as is done in business, you don't measure every box of Cheerios that comes off the line. You measure a sample, and you use that information to inform the decisions that you're making about the things on the input side that you're looking at. And that's how we're doing it with Parent Aware right now, because it's the most cost-effective way. There is no statewide kindergarten entry assessment. It's very expensive to implement and will take some time. We're very confident in the way that we're looking at this right now.
We're going to take the last comment from Senator Nelson, and we're going to proceed to vote. If you could close the computer so we can see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Moss. I understand quality sampling. However, 60% of the funding goes to Head Start programs. It would appear to me that it is a great injustice to exempt 60% of the programs from qualifying by the rating system. I just think that's wrong.
Okay. Senators, we're going to vote on the A-9 amendment. All of those in favor of the A-9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
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 The amendment is not adopted. Senator Peterson.
Division, please.
Division. All of those in favor, please raise your hands. I just was indicating. So could you count?
Six.
All of those opposed? We have six. Is that correct? Yes, the amendment is not adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clausen.
I voted in opposition to this because I was not provided an opportunity to ask questions about the Department of Education here. Already has some standards in place, and I think we should learn a little bit more about those. Seems like we've got two sets going on here. We've got Head Start and school programs, and just because of the inadequacy of knowing more about that, that's why I voted no, and I assume perhaps other people here did the same thing.
Senator, would you like to question the vote and want that presentation to entertain the vote again?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator
So
Peterson.
Moved. Madam Chair, I'd like to I'll leave that alone for a second. Actually, I had a comment to make before that, and it's getting at where Senator Clausen is going. Is there a certain number of questions that we should know are allowed prior to each amendment vote so that we know as members to try to get first in line, because it seems like there's a lot of things here that are yet to be discovered. I mean, I think one of the issues that I had with Senate File 481 out of the gate in meeting with some of the advocates was that a lot of it actually isn't spelled out in the bill. There's a lot of administrative rulemaking involved with this program. A lot of it already exists in statute due to the modest appropriation that was made last biennium. And so there's a lot of information that actually hasn't been presented as it relates to the QRS and how that works. And so is there a number of questions, I guess, number one, that we are allowed per amendment, or are we going to thoroughly vet the issues that are pertinent to this bill in this committee?
Senator, we have had an hour and a half already, so I do have two members who have people here who wish to testify, and I would like to move that. And we have until 11, we have session. We don't have a room for this evening, so I need to move those bills as well. I need to respect the other two members who have brought people here. So let's do our best to get into those questions. Please make sure that if you have questions, Senator Clausen, Senator Peterson, that are different to what is being asked already, let me know immediately so we can dive into that. We have three more amendments that we have to entertain members. So let's move into the A4 amendment. I don't know who has the A4 amendment. I have Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, I don't have the A4 amendment, but I do have a question that is very pertinent.
Before you move, Senator Peterson, I need to know who has the A4 amendment. I have it in front of me. If not, we're not going to move it. Seems like we're not moving the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'm fine with the A4. If someone would
who
like
has
to
the
A4
amendment, I do not know, but it has been prepared. Okay. So we're not going to entertain the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll offer it.
Senator Wieger offers the A4 amendment. Any questions on the A4 amendment?
What does it do, Madam Chair?
Senator Peterson, Senator Wieger, could you explain the amendment?
At line 16 through 18, it reserves up to $189 per adjusted marginal cost pupil unit for programs designed to prepare children and their families for kindergarten. If there's debate or controversy, I can withdraw that. This will go to finance. I was just trying to accommodate whoever prepared this.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I need to get advice. Senator Wieger, I have been told that this will delete your appropriation and change to move it into a different account for preschool programs that are different from what you have suggested. So this deletes your actual
It
deletes the entire bill that you have presented.
I did not see that part of the amendment.
So these actually fundamentally changes your bill and gives the money
that they
to
were okay
somebody else.
Madam Chair.
Senator Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And now this one does deal with funding, so I would imagine this would be jurisdiction of the finance, education finance, not this committee?
Absolutely,
withdraw.
Senator Franson. Thank you. Let's entertain the A7 amendment.
Madam Chair. Seven?
Senator Peterson, is that your amendment? Please proceed to its length.
Yeah. So, members, the A7 amendment just gets at an issue that I think is within the spirit of Senate File 481. There's some language in there that leaves it to the director's discretion to make sure that there's appropriate geographic disbursement of the scholarships. But I think that especially our ex-urban and rural members in particular will be concerned with the difference, I guess, in the disbursements of the scholarships throughout the state. Right now, obviously, they're disproportionately in areas that have a lot of providers, which tend to be city centers and the Twin Cities in general. This amendment would just simply say, give the director more specific direction about dispersing the scholarships throughout the state. While still leaving a latitude to have some inequity, if you can see the final provision on 1.3 says no more than a 5% variation, so we still allow for more to be in some congressional districts, but it does make sure that we're getting these scholarships to kids that need them in every part of the state.
Senator Peterson, would this change kind of the targeted effort that is being proposed by the legislation, Senator Wiegers?
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, I actually don't think it does. I think Senate File 41, again, already refers to the director to try to geographically represent the scholarships. I just, you know, being a member of the legislature, I'm suspicious of administrative authority. And I think the legislature, it is within our purview to make sure that there's proper geographic representation, to make sure that kids in every congressional district are getting equitable treatment as it relates to this program. So if I haven't already, I'd move the A7 amendment.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question on this is, and I appreciate the spirit in which it is intended, but my question is demographics. And, for example, does this reflect if there are changing trends in demographics and there are disproportionately higher numbers of 3- and 4-year-olds in a certain congressional district relative to the overall population? Do we need to make sure that the scholarships are going to where the children are as opposed to where, say, an aging population might be? And that would be my concern with this just being sort of a straight distribution.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Carlson.
Yep, Madam Chair, and Senator Wieger, Senator Peterson, you know, this actually brings up one of my biggest concerns about this entire bill, and that is that we're trying to identify at-risk students, and I think we've missed the point. We know that early childhood does help. I think all the teachers that get a student that comes through readiness knows that this helps. But I think we're missing the point. We're not identifying the students that really need it. I think we're, you know, I've always had a problem, and you know, pardon me, Mr. Grunewald and Art, wherever you are, I've always been a strong supporter of early childhood, but I've had a problem with the disconnect between the concept of finding an at-risk student with the design of a program that is so sophisticated that the person that is going to use it has to get the information, has to make a very sophisticated financial and family decision to put a child into a school that's going to help them. Now, after you make that decision, is that student even at risk anymore? What about those students where the parents can't read, where they don't have English skills, where they move a lot, where they're so out of the mainstream that they don't find these scholarships. They don't find these scholarships useful. I think what we're not getting the student that really needs it the worst. And I think that what we're ignoring that, we're putting a bar there, and we're ignoring everyone that's under the bar. And that's, I think, what we need to start looking at here. If we're really going to attack the disparity and the gap, we have to find those students that are going to miss this entirely. And this isn't in support or opposition to your amendment, but the fact that Senator Kent said here is we need to look at the demographic that needs it. We need to find that demographic that needs it. And it may not be putting together a large, sophisticated decision-making process that a parent has to go through. And once they've gone through it, they know what their student is capable of, and they are now capable of educating a young kid far more than that family that isn't able to go through that sophisticated evaluation. So that's where I'm at yet with this bill, at the very basics of it. That's where I am with the Rolnick study and also the results of that study.
So, Ms. Hilden, on two issues. Senator Peterson is proposing to do this across the 8th congressional districts and whether or not, that is a fair distribution. And the second one, I think, that Senator Carlson is asking for is whether or not the system that we have could be is open and is simple enough to be accessed by the very people that you're trying to help in terms of them being the low-income individuals who actually don't understand how this system works, so how the family actually access that, what are the provisions that actually the stipulations in here that open access. So those are two questions, I think. Please, if you could.
Madam Chair, very briefly, to Senator Peterson's amendment, an even distribution, while it sounds nice and fair based on geography, is not necessarily fair when it comes to where poor children are. There is poor children in every county, so we would submit, and I've had Mr. Grunwald look at this amendment too, and he concurs that we're trying to target where the kids are, not try to make up distribution based on political lines. To the point that Senator Carlson made, this is why we need this scholarship program or this scholarship aid. We have home visiting nurses that know how to find these. You heard from Mary Kozak in Blanded. They did the whole county of Itasca and helped find the families that need this help and help them get into the programs that are making a difference. If we continue to think that we can kind of, be confused about this, that's unfortunate. What these organizations that have all signed on to this proposal agree with is that we know what works, we know how to find the kids, and we got to fund it. We got to do it if we're going to really make a difference. So your concerns are well taken. We'll come back and visit with you further, but we know how to find these kids.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, do you support this amendment?
No.
Senator Peterson, this is the last comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think it's actually very relevant to Senator Kent's point. Just as a point of clarification, if I could get them to respond to a question that will lead me into the rest of my comments, what exactly is 185% of the federal poverty level?
I think the staff should be able to help with that. Mary Orr, perhaps, or somebody. Mr. Grunwald, please. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, Rob Grunwald, it's just over $40,000 for a family of four.
And Mr. Grunwald, what's the median household income in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Grunwald.
So just over 50, if I remember correct.
Honestly, I don't have that right off the top of my head, but it's just about over 50.
So what we're talking about is in congressional districts of just under 700,000 people, 185% of the federal poverty level, which gets at your question, is going to encompass a significant number, hundreds of thousands of people, tens of thousands of families. So to suggest that there's not kids who are poor as defined in the bill, and that's why we shouldn't have geographic representation, I think it doesn't really hold up to an examination of facts as it relates to where these kids live that qualify under Senate File 481. So just to be clear and on the record, there literally is tens of thousands of families who would qualify in every single congressional district. And that's why I think it is part of our responsibility, Ms. Hilden and Senator Wieger, to look at where the need is, and I absolutely agree with that. But I think as defined in your bill, there's need in every district. And it's also our responsibility as representatives of our area to make sure that our constituents are looked out for just as much as other constituents in other congressional districts. I think that's the give and take, I guess, here at the legislature. I would urge members to consider this, and I think that members of your respective caucuses, our respective caucuses, will consider this a very important amendment as we move along.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. On the A7 amendment, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Madam Chair, I'd like to request a roll call.
A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will take the roll.
Senator Torres-Ray.
No.
Senator Dahl.
No.
Senator Nelson.
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yes.
Senator Clausen.
No.
Senator Franzen.
No.
Senator Johnson.
No.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Nenow.
Yes.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Rood. Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Wieger.
No.
Senator Wicklin.
No.
Senator Carlson did not vote. Could you not? Senator, you didn't call Senator Carlson.
Senator Carlson.
No.
There being 5 yes and 9 no's, the amendment is not adopted. We have the A8 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson, is this your amendment?
The A8 is my amendment. I'd like to move the A8 amendment.
Please proceed, Senator.
So, Madam Chair, again, if I could just ask a few questions for background to members of the committee of,
please proceed quickly.
Of the testifiers. If members of the Mini Minds campaigns or Senator Wieger could tell us about the number of quality rated programs in each one of the categories as it relates to school-based pre-K, Head Start, center-based care, family care, both public and private, the disbursement of those programs that have been rated. I've seen a spreadsheet that shows quite a disparity in terms of the rated number of family care providers versus government-run providers. And I think the reason I bring it up is because I think the spirit of this program, when we made the appropriation last biennium and as it's been conveyed to us as legislators, is that there's going to be kind of this marketplace of options for families. And even in the graphic here, if you go to your packet, members, and page 5 or 6, you'll see this graphic here that shows scholarships in these arrows here, and they point to all of these different kinds of programs. And what is kind of inferred, I guess, or what you're supposed to infer, is that all of these programs are kind of equally represented in the disbursement of scholarships. I saw some data here, and hopefully they have that, and I'm sure they do, that shows that the disbursement amongst these programs between public and private providers is actually quite stark. There are some legitimate reasons to that, but I'll let them provide some of the data and the background on that issue.
Senator Wieger, could you tell us what is your position on this amendment?
I oppose.
Thank you. I think Ms. Orr is at the table. If you could
Tell us what are the implications for the distribution and the limitation on this.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, you are currently right now there is a difference in the implementation of Parent Aware. The accelerated rating, which applies to the center-based programs, Head Start, and preschool programs, is available statewide. The rollout of the full ratings, which would apply to non-accredited family child care and center-based child care, is occurring year by year between now and 2015. So currently, there is a disproportionate number of accelerated programs because that option is more uniformly available across the state. But as we proceed with the full rollout of Parent Aware between now and 2015, we expect the distribution of types of programs participating and the distribution of ratings, one to the number of providers and programs that qualify for 1, 2, 3, 4 will be more evenly distributed as the time goes on.
Any more questions, Senators? Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, do you have the exact numbers? Because you had mentioned that it's disproportionate. If I remember correctly, there was something like 230 Head Start programs, and there were six of the 11,000 family care providers that were. So it's 229 or something like that to six family care providers. And again, I don't think that's what in the advocacy for this program that was really that picture was painted very clearly, and it's certainly not representative of what this graphic shows here. I'm just wondering if you have the exact numbers, because I think it paints a clearer picture.
Madam Chair, Senator, as of December 31st of 2012, 126 school-based pre-K were participating in Parent Aware, 225 Head Start, and then accredited child care centers, 91. Accredited family child care, 15. Non-accredited child care centers, 16. And then non-accredited family child care, 56. So a total of 529.
Any more questions, Senators? If not, on the eight amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator, just if I could make one comment,
if
just
you
to
could
bring it,
Senator Peterson.
Just to bring the amendment kind of full circle. So, members, you heard kind of the breakdown, and so what the amendment gets to is to say we're going to make it intentional that there is at least some attempt, not even a majority. We still allow for a majority of the scholarships to go to Head Start and school-based pre-K, but we're going to make an explicit attempt to make sure that there are both private and public options, which I think was what we were told when we were lobbied and advocated to on this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence.
Senator Kent, do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I would like to request that we could be provided that information that was just read out. If somebody could get
Thank
that
you.
To us,
Ms.
that'd be great. Go ahead. I was just going to say, again, to Senator Peterson's amendment here, I think the spirit in which it is intended is fair, but just like with the previous one, we're setting up these sort of guidelines, these walls that may not necessarily reflect. And I think, the evolution of where this is going, we have to have built-in flexibility to get there. So it is in that spirit that I think it's well-intended, but if it were modified, maybe it would be something we could consider. But the way this is right now, it's just too rigid.
Thank you, Senator Kent. Ms. Orr, could you make sure that you distribute that information that you just read so that members will have information about the different programs? Senator Thompson.
I'd just like to request a roll call, Madam Chair.
A roll call has been requested, and the clerk will
Madam
take the
Chair.
Roll. Dr. Cadigan, if you could be brief, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Karen Cadigan, Director of the Office of Early Learning. I wanted to clarify an important point about where the scholarship distribution is, which is quite different than where the rated programs are right now. At our most recent report for the state-funded early learning scholarships, 83 of those are being used in Head Start program or school-based pre-K. 248 of them are being used in child care, licensed child care, or family-based child care. For the Race to the Top scholarships, the distribution is similar. 107, the vast majority of those raised to the top scholarships are being used in child care, licensed or family child care, and 5 are being used in school-based or Head Star settings.
Thank you. Thank you. This is very helpful, Dr. Kelly. And if you could also distribute that information for the members, that would be very helpful. Brad, if you could proceed.
Senator Torres-Ray.
No.
Senator Dahl.
No.
Senator Nelson.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
No.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yes.
Senator Clausen.
No.
Senator Franzen.
No.
Senator Johnson.
No.
Senator Kent.
No.
Senator Nenow.
Yes.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Rood. Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Wigger.
No.
Senator Wicklund.
No.
We have 5 yes and 9 no's. The amendment is not adopted. Senator Wigger, if you could proceed to move your bill.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I want to thank everyone. I didn't see the amendments beforehand, just as the one that we worked out last night. We didn't have that. I know we're looking at committee deadlines. I'm willing to entertain any of the suggestions you have presented, and please contact me, members. It doesn't mean I'm going to vote, just as there was an earlier version that I would have put out for a vote that we withdrew. It doesn't mean I'm going to support it necessarily, but it means that we'll talk about it. And I want to remind everyone again that business, nonprofits, they've developed this. They have made a commitment in their 4-tiered plan to fund this long term. And that's why I've opposed some of the suggestions, just in respect to what they've come up with in their plea for flexibility, but ultimately accountability. So,
thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate File 41 as recommended to pass and be re-referred to Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator. Two brief comments, Senator Nelson, and then Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wigger, thank you for your pledge to continue to work on this bill. There are many of us. I was a supporter of MELF before. I want to support this bill. But there are some problems in the bill right now, and I would continue to take you up on your offer to work on that so that we get to what your goal is, which is that we have high-quality child care for those students who are not ready for school, who are not ready for kindergarten. But there's some issues here that we need to deal with regarding making sure that happens in this bill. So I'd like to work with you on some of those amendments that didn't pass today, but hopefully we can get them in the future. And then one clarification, Madam Chair. I thought I heard you say in discussion of this bill that it adds $4 million to early childhood to the $700 million that we're already spending, but that's not what I see in the bill, actually. So I would like Senator Wigger to clarify exactly the spending in the bill.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, actually, the prerogative, this amount really does not mean anything because it will go to Senator Wigger's committee, and then the distribution actually will be in his committee. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those numbers, Senator, should not be there, but you correct me, Senator Wigger. I presume this bill was introduced that way, but I don't think that those numbers should be there right now.
Madam Chair, I agree. Finally, there were many people that didn't testify that are here to support, perhaps some that didn't, but one former senator representing White Bear Lake is here, John Milton, and I just wanted to thank him for his advocacy on this. He served in the early 70s.
Thank you, Senator Milton. We're happy that you're here. We're sorry that we have little time to have a conversation, but thank you for being here. Senator Chamberlain had a question, or Senator Thompson, is your question related to Senator Nelson's?
No.
Senator Chamberlain,
please go first.
Quickly. Again, we all want the same thing. We want kids that we want to close the achievement gap. We want to improve academic standards so that they do not get stuck in a cycle, a lifetime of poverty. We want to break that cycle. But I humbly submit this will not do that because we are still measuring inputs. And I don't. We're still measuring inputs, and we're not changing the fundamental equation here. And that's a great, great concern. And I think what we're doing here is pushing a status quo. We're going to create a whole new system of entitlements that's skewed, as we've heard today, with different things. That being the case, I would share Senator Nelson's desire to hopefully work with you to have to get something in here that tends that will bend that a little bit and mitigate that a bit, because across the country, these things haven't worked. Not in Oklahoma, not in Georgia. Handed that data out to you. Article and another piece of data that showed what happened in Oklahoma and Georgia. It simply has not worked. And we spend $770 million a year on this stuff. It hasn't worked. But here we're going to go and we're going to leap into this and do the same thing. I just challenge members and the people in the audience and the folks in the state to take a serious look at this stuff. This is not working. It hasn't worked. And I don't know what's in this bill that will change that fundamental equation that we're trying to stuff into this with the state and give to the citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Final comment, very brief, Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would just point out that there is language in this bill pertaining to cost. Starting line 4.8, $78 million in fiscal year 2014 and $105 million in fiscal year 15 are appropriated from the general fund of the Commissioner of Education for transfer to the Office of Early Learning for Early Education Scholarship Awards under Section 1. The base appropriation for this program for fiscal year 2016 is $150 million. And Madam Chair, I've registered this concern before. Typically in the Senate, the Committee of Original Jurisdiction has allowed a wide-ranging discussion on any aspect of a bill. And I think this idea that we are supposed to somehow vote on the policy in a vacuum, irrespective and regardless of cost, it's not realistic. As Senator Chamberlain pointed out, this is money that will be redistributed, right? Because there's going to be a disproportionately high percentage of money going to certain areas than other areas, maybe justifiably so. I'm not questioning that. The point is it's redistributing funds. Unless you assume that there's going to be tax increases that cover all of this, it will take money out of the classroom and put into other programs. And I've obviously got concerns about the bill, but I think the larger thing for me, Madam Chair, is I hope we don't continue this notion, although I realize we've got a committee deadline here on Friday, that, well, you've got to vote for something irrespective of the cost. Nobody operates that way. I would never sit down at the dinner table and say to my wife, should we replace our car? What's the cost? Oh, you don't get to know that. That's irrelevant. I want to know about the policy. Do you want a new car? It has to be attached to the cost. And this idea that we don't have fiscal notes prepared and we don't know the cost and that we're actually not supposed to ask about the cost before voting on something, it makes no sense. If we told the people of Minnesota, I go out to my district, well, I voted for Senate file X. Well, what's the cost? Oh, I don't know. We don't get to know that. We just vote on the policy. Are you kidding me?
Senator, I want to make sure that I am clear on what I said and I am clear on explaining what we're doing here. We could have a fiscal note. That's a point well taken. The question before you and the work that we are doing in the policy committee is reviewing whether or not the elements of a program, the elements of distribution, if there is funding attached to it, actually make sense. Now, there is a policy question, equally important, which is can we afford to pay it? I think that's a very important point. Now, the policy committee will engage in the discussion about how these things work. So in your analogy of the car, what we need to say here is whether or not we need a car, yes or no. Then you will go on to have a discussion about what kind of a car you can afford. So here what we're saying is definitely we need a car, why we need a car, etc. That's what we're doing in the policy committee. In Senator Wigger's committee, you will find out whether or not you have the money to afford that particular car and whether or not you can buy an inexpensive car or an expensive car. So I hope that that is clear. If it helps to you, I'm going to try. It's difficult for me to request a fiscal note because that's just not what we do. But I will be happy to ask so that you at least know. I think that's a, you know, that's a legitimate concern. At least you should know what
Thank
is the
you.
Cost. On the on Senator Wigger's motion, all of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
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 The bill is referred to judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Wicklund. We are going to move into Senate File 1024. Since we have some people who are here from the early childhood group who wanted to be part of this discussion, we're going to have that first. So Senator Wicklund will present the 1024.
Should have a staff.
Senate File 1024. Senator, thank you. A
thank
question,
you.
Members, just so that, you know, we spent 2 hours on the other bill. Do we have an amendments to this bill that need to be printed, that you are presenting, that we would like, that you would like us to kind of get ahead and we will not have any amendments? Senator, are you presenting any amendments, Senator Wicklund?
No, Madam Chair, I do not have amendments
okay,
to the
thank
bill.
You. Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you.
Senator
thank you.
Proceeds.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm here today to move the Senate file number 1024. This is a bill that relates to education and state government. It creates a Department of Early Care and Education, and it does so by moving programs from the Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and Department of Health into this new Department of Early Care and Education. The purpose is to create a department that will ensure that every child through the age of 5 receives a fair and full opportunity to reach their full potential. I won't reiterate some of the statistics that have been presented in the previous bill regarding the benefits of early childhood education, early childhood care that is high quality. We know that, as was stated before, 50% or slightly less of kids are not coming to kindergarten prepared. And our goal is to have all kids ready for K by the year 2020. So I'm going to just focus on more what are the compelling reasons for a better, a more specific system change to coordinate programs within our state government. I believe that parents and children have a very complicated path through the system to find the best resources to meet their needs. I believe that through better coordination, we can have a delivery of higher quality care and education. And I believe that one thing we haven't talked about this morning is about how much a significant amount of money is being spent by the government, but also a significant amount of money is being spent by parents. 50% of the money is coming from private sources, from parents, and 20% is public money. We want to have the ability to ensure that this large amount of money spent by government in multiple departments is being spent in an efficient and coordinated manner. Also, I believe that fragmentation amongst departments, it can also lead to service gaps. Are we really addressing all of the children that we need to address? I mean, we know that that isn't the case, but are there actual areas that we are not addressing through our services? I was going to go through, kind of walk through the bill, but given that we have very limited time, I'm just going to stay at a very high level in order to make sure that the testifiers that are here today are able to speak. The section one, it talks about the reasons that we believe that creating the new department will help children reach their full potential.
We believe that fostering collaboration between childcare, Head Start, early childhood education, school readiness, family, friends and neighbor providers, and other childhood programs will be beneficial. We believe that this new department will help to develop a seamless service delivery system for early education and care programs, which is important for efficient and effective use of the funds. And we believe that this will help children by establishing an administrative framework for and promoting the development of early education and care services, such that services shall be available in every community for all families that express a need for them. Section 3 highlights the commissioner, a definition, and the definition of duties of that commissioner. Section 4 goes over the specific programs that will be transferred to the new department, and that would be from education, from human services, and from the Department of Health. Section 6 talks about the commissioner designee shall review and reevaluate the powers and duties after July 1st of 2013, and those that are consistent with the purpose and goals of the Department of Early Care and Education will be transferred effective November 1st. So this allows for an opportunity for the commissioner designee to review the programs with the current heads of the departments to determine are these the correct programs to be transferred to the new department. I have two handouts, and if they could be distributed at this time. I just want to highlight two sources of information that I found in researching this this subject. One of them is from the GAO, from the Government Accountability Office. It comes from the GAO 2012 Annual Report on Opportunities to Reduce Duplication, Overlap, and Fragmentation. This report states that the Department of Education and Department of Health and Human Services should extend their coordination efforts to other federal agencies with early learning and child care programs to mitigate the effects of program fragmentation and to simplify children's access to these services. It's also in another place in the report, it's to the extent that programs in different agencies have similarities, fragmentation and program overlap can create an environment in which programs may not serve children and families as efficiently and effectively as possible. Also, it's stated that multiple programs can create added administrative costs, such as duplicating reporting requirements and duplicating eligibility determinations. So that is one report that the segment is being distributed at this time. Another report I'd like to highlight is the Office of Early Learning Report, and this was created in January of 2011. This was prepared for the Early Childhood Advisory Council, and I'll just highlight in the executive summary, the recommendation stated in this report was that the task force and the Early Childhood Advisory Council recommends that Minnesota establish a freestanding Office of Early Learning headed by a cabinet-level position with authority and responsibility for policy, fiscal, and rulemaking within the scope of programs currently housed in the Minnesota Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and the Department of Health, as selected by the task force with direction from legislation. In this report, they also described other models that were considered, such as collaboration or virtual departments, and those were not recommended by the task force. And I believe that executive summary is being distributed. So with that, I will ask that I move to the testifiers who are here who can highlight areas from their respective expertise.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome, and please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to address Senate File 1024. Excuse me. My name's Denise Mayat, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation, which is a Minnesota-based foundation that funds early childhood and after-school programs statewide. And I'm also the co-chair of the Start Early Funders Coalition that's composed of over 20 foundations that fund early childhood programs across the state. And I'm also a member of the Governor's Early Learning Council. I represented the funding community and Start Early on the task force that we were hearing about previously that made a recommendation to Governor Dayton in early 2011 to establish an independent Office of Early Learning after looking at models from numerous states that have such a body. We were, of course, very pleased when an Office of Early Learning was established under the auspices of the Department of Education, but always felt that eventually an independent office that brought together all of the resources and public funding streams for early childhood was essential to ensure that Minnesota children were ready for kindergarten. It all comes down to the issue of accountability, the accountability that a cabinet-level person committed to young children would have to ensure that all of the programs serving them are aligned, coordinated, and fully funded. Minnesota has made great strides in this direction with its current Office of Early Learning, but to fully take advantage of the gains made through the Race to the Top grant and other work that's going on in the state, a department whose top priority is early learning and who's not distracted by competing priorities is essential. A cabinet-level leader would serve as a single point of contact for legislators, other agency staff, and leaders outside of government. An Office of Early Care and Education could more easily create public-private partnerships that stretch state dollars and more fully engage the business and philanthropic communities. It would heighten the profile of early childhood education in the state, and it would improve communication with the general public, including and especially with parents. It would integrate programs and create system linkages, create a seamless delivery system with local points of entry for early care and education systems that are administered by local, state, and federal agencies. This system's already been pioneered by the Blandon Foundation with their Invest Early program, and you heard about this earlier this morning from Mary Kozak. It's worked very well for parents in Itasca County. Finally, it would be in a key position to oversee a coordinated data system to measure the progress that our state is making in getting young children ready for kindergarten. And this is really essential because in spite of the gains we're making, Minnesota has one of the worst achievement gaps in the country between low-income and mostly children of color and their more privileged counterparts. There's a lot of energy right now to address this issue, and this energy could be focused and augmented by a Department of Early Care and Education with full cabinet authority that would work in partnership with private organizations and individuals who see this issue for what it is, the chance to support Minnesota's most vulnerable children to be ready to learn and to someday be part of a workforce that builds Minnesota's future. I really want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to the issue and for all of your continued work on behalf of young children and their families in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mayo. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Education Policy Committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony this morning on Senate File 1024. My name is Luz Maria Frias, and I serve as Vice President of the Minneapolis Foundation. And I'm also a member of the Start Early Funders Coalition, which was referenced by my colleague, Denise Mayotte. As a community foundation, our purpose is to join with others to strengthen our community in measurable and sustainable ways for the benefit of all residents, especially those who are disadvantaged. The Minneapolis Foundation's focus is centered on a framework of equity, economic equity, social equity, and racial equity. Today's Minnesota is not the Minnesota of yesteryear. Our demographics and poverty levels have changed substantially. Our state is much more diverse across all 87 counties, more than ever before. The growth in diversity is no longer limited to the core urban cities. While children from small towns grow up, go off to college, and never return, families of color seeking jobs are relocating into these small towns across Minnesota and reinvigorating those towns with new energy, opening small businesses on Main Street, keeping schools open, and adding to the local economy. In 2000, 21.5% of Minnesota's children ages 0 to 4 were children of color. Yet 10 years later, it increased by 58% to 31% of all children. At the same time, families across the state are struggling financially in greater numbers than ever. Minnesota's poverty rate in 2000 was 7.9%, yet 10 years later, there's been a 50% increase in that number. The poverty rate isn't what most of us grew up with, nor is it consistent with the vision that we have for our children and our grandchildren. And although there are programs in place across the various departments to provide resources, those programs are spread across multiple departments, and they operate too often in silos, lacking the efficiency and coordination that would be afforded under one roof. One of the most appealing provisions of Senate File 1024 is under Section 1, Subdivision 2, Sub 12, as it pertains to developing and managing an effective data collective system to enable an accurate evaluation of the department's impact. And as you debate the merits of this legislation, members from both sides of the aisle can agree on one thing: what gets measured gets done. Section 3, Sub 2B requires that the commission report biennially to the appropriate legislative body regarding various measures, including the progress of moving toward a system of universal early education and care for preschool children through the age of five. Universal early education is a goal of the Minneapolis Foundation because nearly 50% of Minnesota children enter kindergarten not fully prepared to succeed. Senate File 1024 provides accountability for the delivery of state services at a time that taxpayers are demanding efficient delivery of services and a return on their investment. I applaud Senators Wicklund, Sharon, Lowry, and Torres Ray for having the courage and creativity to think outside the box in creating a new department. It's a solution to a problem that has stifled our state's progress for too long. Just as our demographics and poverty rates are not those of yesteryear, nor should we be constrained to the state government's approach of yesteryear. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Frias. Please proceed.
Madam Senator Ray and Senator Committee members, my name is Samira Bilal-Roby. I represent Early Childhood Resource and Training Center and Prevent Child Abuse and Neglect Minnesota. I've been in working with families for 25 years in this field. I'm going to make a very short statement. I'm here today sharing my support and my colleagues' support and thoughts in the early childhood field and families. Cohesiveness, navigating systems without anxieties and comprehension is a number one asset. Our commitment is quality service. The act or process concerning the condition of learning is the cohesiveness exhibited with families through government. The system must intentionally work toward aligning the departments one to satisfy the emotional needs the communities readily understand is accessible. I thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Bilal. We really appreciate that you're here. We know that you have extensive experience in working with providers.
Yes.
It will be helpful for us to hear about the work that you do and the number of child care providers that you work with.
Thank you. As I said, I've been working in this field since 1994. We do training and education of the providers and the parents to make sure that they do quality care. We mostly work with those that are unrepresented throughout the state. So we work with those that come from another language, those who are new Americans and immigrants, who really have the initiative to do quality care. And we work with American Indian, African American, and the Latino communities also. Our work is to make sure that they are at the tables, that we really hear what they need. And one of the things that we know that they need is that cohesiveness. They need departments to really understand what their needs are. They need to be able to do one shop of service or shopping. Our providers are not only child care providers, they are also parents. This work that I have done in particular, I am a grandmother, I'm 60 years old.
So I'm a grandmother. I have worked as a provider. I have been a parent in this field of early childhood education for many, many years. I have watched and worked with MDE. I have worked with DHS. And I know what it will feel like, what it does feel like, if you do not feel connected within these systems. So I hope I answered your question on the work that we do or that I do.
Thank you, Mrs. Villa. Thank you so much. Any questions from members? Any questions to the author? Senator Nelson.
Just a couple comments and then a couple questions. Well, I really like the title of this report that you handed out from the GAO, Opportunities to Reduce Duplication, Overlap, and Fragmentation, Achieve Savings, and Enhance Revenue. That's a good description of what we should be doing in government. And so I like that. And I also like the fact that your initiative, Senator Wicklund, includes getting those child care assistance programs under the same umbrella as early learning, which might get to the amendment I was trying to put on Senator Wieger's bill. I think that's the problem. In government, we just keep adding to. We cannot do that, members. It is not sustainable. We have to look at what we're already doing and be willing to restructure and reform. So I'm hoping that's the intent of the legislation here. And so, but with that, I like that part of it, and I like the coordination and the collaboration, but it brings a question to my mind as well. One of the other things that we are dealing with in this committee is this silo effect of particularly alignment between we're dealing directly with K-12 and higher ed, and how can it be that 75% of the kids that graduate from high school aren't ready for higher ed? And so we're working in this committee to try and better align K-12 initiatives with higher ed so that there's a seamless transition. So my question then is now at the other end. If we pull out the early childhood and it's in its own department, what is going to prevent us from having the same problem on the early end that we have on the late end? In other words, we're not going to have the coordination between making sure that our early childhood programs actually prepare students to be prepared for kindergarten, much as we want to make sure our K-12 system prepares students to be ready to succeed in college. So I see a danger here, and I'd like you to address that.
Senator Wakely.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I think that you're correct in saying that there could be a possibility that if you separate them, that then you lose that linkage between the early child care and the early elementary years. And I do agree that there's great importance in the alignment of early childhood education and the K-3, especially. In Bloomington, where I come from, we have been doing a lot of work to understand how do we make sure that we have that alignment from preschool all the way through, you know, the early elementary years. And I think that that needs to happen going forward. I think that that can happen even though there are separate departments. I think it will take conscious effort on our parts to do that, just as we are not going to create a K through higher ed department. That will be two separate areas. I think we'll have to accommodate it within, or we can accommodate it, even though we have a focus in early learning and a focus on K through 12. I think that it can still happen. It will require vigilance, though. I do agree with that, to make sure that the programs and the alignment work is going on.
Senator Nelson, a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wicklund. So I appreciate your focus, and that we'll need to make sure that we do have strong alignment there. And then my second question has to go to the cost, which I don't see here, but I understand that will be coming, and weighing, you know, that cost-benefit analysis. And to that point, there's two comments. One is in lines 3.9 through 3.12, it talks about measuring the progress towards a universal early education and care for preschool children through the age of five. And that strikes me on two levels. One, I don't think that's a very good measure. I think we need some real metrics, like are kids prepared for kindergarten? So just to say that we're having early childhood education or universal early childhood education and childcare, I think is not good enough. We should be looking at some real metrics. I liked what Senator Wieger put into his bill. We can't do it at this early age, but what you're seeing, is there a year's growth and a year's worth of time? And so I'd encourage you to look at some sort of metric in measurement for effectiveness beyond just participation. We cannot keep focusing on inputs. We have to focus on outputs. And so I'd like to encourage that. And then because I know we always have challenges, funding challenges in the state of Minnesota, like every business, every family, my question would be the area that we know Minnesota is so severely lagging on is our achievement gap. We have the largest achievement gap in the nation, I believe, or the second largest, and that is so unacceptable. And so my question would be kind of this balance between saying we're going to focus on universal and everyone as opposed to being a little bit more targeted in our approach. And I'd appreciate your comment on that as well. So the metrics and the lack of the targeted approach are the two things I'd like to hear your comments about.
Sure. Senator Wieger. Senator Wick.
Madam Chair.
I was just thinking that we just went through 2 hours with Senator Wieger on the targeted versus the broad, and now we're going back. So, Senator Wick, we try to answer that one.
Yes, Senator, or Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. First, in terms of the report, I'd be happy to work with you on how we could better define that. I think some of the questions that I would ask are, do we have a way that's a standardized way to measure some of these outputs? I know that we don't have a standard kindergarten assessment across Minnesota. We don't have some of these things are not, it's not as easy to maybe point out, you know, what's the commonly understood measure. So, but I agree that, you know, that we do need to put more specifics in there, or we expect more specifics, and I'd be happy to work with you on, you know, ways we could better define that statement. Let's see, your second question regarding
the targeted
universal
targeting.
Versus targeted.
Yes, I believe that we need to start out perhaps with a more targeted approach, and perhaps testifiers here would be willing to answer that as well. I think to get the most impact, perhaps it would be better to say we're going to start with an effort to target the most at-risk children. I mean, that would potentially generate the best results. And I don't know if any of the testifiers, would you have any other comments, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. And, you know, a couple of, just before the testifiers come in, I think that we have, Senator Nelson, some ideas. I think that your input is really welcome in terms of, you know, do we really need more substance into the report? I think that would be fantastic. And, you know, the targeted effort is something that we just had, you know, tremendous discussion. If you ask some of us, we totally are for the targeted effort. But to begin a process that, you know, really serves all children, all regions, perhaps is a good idea to start with that and figure out where do we go after we learn what's going on with these kids. But Mrs. Mayotte, I think you had a...
Well, I was just going to add that many of the programs that would be brought into this department are targeted towards low-income children. And so just by nature of how the department would be created, I think that there would be an assumption of targeted to begin with, of course, the desire at some point to be universal.
Thank you. I think that's a very good point, Ms. Mayotte. I constantly say in this particular committee, I have been made so aware of the fact that we constantly come with requests for expanding funding for these populations, and we actually don't know quite well what is happening with the actual funding. So I don't know who requested or who put together these. It comes from MDE, but it does provide the funding breakdowns for the different programs, and that's where I got the $771 million that are currently allocated. Senator Kent, and then Senator
Chamberlain.
Oh, Senator Chamberlain.
Presentation,
item 14. Okay.
Came off of that one.
Yeah, this is good. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just would add into this discussion about what we're going to set up as our metrics for expectations. We've established the universal expectation of K-ready by 2020. So that's the goal. And then what we need to do is talk about the targeted strategies we need to achieve that universal goal. So I think there's some language that we can adjust as we move forward.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Wicklund, I wanted also to make you aware, I don't know if this was shared with you, but in 2010, the MDE and MDH actually put together a report that is called Early Learning Study, Move and Standards. It's a report to the legislature that actually describes how to do this. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to actually come up with the ideas of how this is going to work. It's already been done, and we will distribute it to the committee members if you are interested in seeing this. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the commissioner going to testify, Commissioner Casalius, or one of her representatives, as it relates to this bill?
Senator, I did not ask the commissioner, but if she wishes to provide any input, we welcome, of course, her.
Madam Chair, significant portion of her department away, and just if she
Senator,
could share
one issue
on that
has been important. This is going to go also to Health and Human Services, so these commissioners have been working together very diligently, and also, of course, with the funding that came from, the feds. They have been doing some of this work, but welcome, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senators, I'd like to thank Senator Wicklund for her work on this bill and trying to provide better services and better government for our littlest of children. The governor, a few years ago, established a children's cabinet in which I work with Lucinda Jessen and also Commissioner Ellinger, and we have been working very closely together on these issues and prioritizing pre-K and early learning for quite a long time. We've also established the Office of Early Learning under the Minnesota Department of Education, which we feel is spectacular. It's led by Dr. Cadigan, who is quite an expert on birth to five, and very involved. And so at this point, we believe that the structures that we have currently are adequate and working well. And I have Kevin here if you have anything you'd like to ask of Mr. McHenry as well.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, so you said, Commissioner, just to clarify, you said that you believe this, the structures and the way the department is going about things now is working well. Would that mean that you think that that should continue that way, or that you are, the administration or yourself, are in support of the Department of Early Care and Education, the creation thereof?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, at this point, the governor has put in place, we believe, structures that are working for us well with the early childhood distribution and the Race to the Top grant program that we're doing, as well as our quality rating program to expand our scholarship investments that we've had.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, I've shared this concern with you before. One of my concerns is that I think your department is overworked and understaffed. And I think that the what is the interaction? Where I'm getting at is what is the interaction between some of the revenue streams that your department has, particularly maybe Race to the Top grants, federal grants, maybe FTEs that are federally funded, and what this bill would potentially do to some of those FTEs? Is there any interaction there, or how would that affect your department's ability to operate effectively?
Well, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, well, thank you for the concern of the department being over capacity. I agree with that statement that there is quite a bit of work that we do generate in the department. However, within our Office of Early Learning, We are well-staffed, and we are providing and doing the scholarships that we have been initiated through the previous legislature. In terms of our administration of the programming that we do, Dr. Cadigan has led that with the Department of Health as well as the Department of Human Services and the distribution of those funds, and they've been working quite well together as a sub-cabinet, a mini-cabinet in the distribution of those funds. They meet very regularly and work together, but the funds are separate in each of the agencies, but the administration of those funds, they work collaboratively getting those out.
Senator Peterson. Okay. Senator, Commissioner, could you tell us about, so this is temporary funding. We have $45 million, and the salaries of these individuals are being paid out of these federal dollars that you received. So could you give us a sense of kind of the timeline as to, you know, how long this staff and this actual collaboration could last, since it depends on federal funding?
Madam Chair, I'll ask Dr. Cadigan to speak directly to the Race to the Top staffing and how we've staffed up, as well as our current staffing and what we have in the department.
Thank you. Welcome back, Dr. Cadigan.
Good morning again, Madam Chair and Senators. My name is Karen Cadigan. I'm the Director of the Office of Early Learning. We work, starting with the application of the Race to the Top grant, work very closely with our sister agencies, including Mary Orr, who you heard from, and Peggy Diebel at the Department of Health, who's here. The Race to the Top grant provides some funding for staff. The vast majority of the funding, of course, goes actually for programs for children. So the funding, the FTE funding that I believe we presented in this committee about a month ago during a very brief presentation, is a balance of state funding and federal funding. So some of the positions have been around for a while, and some of the positions are directly attached to the Race to the Top grant. I can't remember the exact number right now, but I can certainly get that information to the committee.
Thank you. Dr. Cadigan, so most of the collaboration and gains that we've made in terms of putting together the database and everything was funded through federal dollars?
The data system in particular is funded through federal dollars, yes, through the Race to the Top grant.
Do we have any funding to maintain that after that federal expires?
We are working on a plan for sustainability of that data system. We have until 2015 to finish that plan.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Senators? Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Dr. Cadigan. Senator Wicklund, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 1024, and I don't know if it's to be referred to Health and Human Services Policy. Is that correct?
That is correct, Senator. We will go to Health and Human Services with this bill. So moved. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you very much.
Senator Dahl, we're going to begin with your bill and go as far as we can with some of the testimony, and then we will continue at 5:30 in room 125. But we will start right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think we can get this bill done in 15 minutes. I'm going
okay,
to.
Okay, Senator, I like that.
Yes. Would you like me to move the amendments right away?
I think that would be great. So you have amendments that will put your bill in the shape that you want for discussion, or what are the
that's
amendments,
right.
Senator?
That's okay. Right. So I'll move Senate File 1103. Before that, the A2 amendment.
Okay.
And the A2 amendment really is just taking out the the task force that's the end of the bill, and it's really kind of a we're moving the task force on its own just to meet deadlines in terms of the state and local government piece. So it's an important part of our overall bill, but we're going to just delete that out of this bill for now.
Okay, on the A2 amendment, so the author is an author's amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The A2 amendment is adopted. And then please proceed, Senator.
Madam Chair, the A3 amendment, I believe this puts the bill into some order that the department requested, but also matches it up a little better with the House version. It's the A3 amendment.
On the A3 amendments, amendment, any questions? If not, all of those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Okay. Well, members, Madam Chair, members, this bill is really, if I would say, a child of the Assessment and Accountability for College and Career Readiness Working Group. We did get a presentation earlier in the year in what that working group recommended. And this particular bill has gone through at least 9 drafts, I think, maybe 10, maybe 9. With a number of people that were actually on that task force or working group, and 2 of them here right now. We've had a number of meetings, and I'm working with Representative Brainard in the House, who was on that working group as well. So a lot of work has obviously been done over the before this working group put its report out. So we're talking about hours and hours and hours of work. And then, of course, we've done dozens and dozens of hours of work since the session started, also in trying to prepare legislation that met up with the working group's recommendations. You know, if we think about what we've done in this committee, we've heard from a number of testifiers over the course of these few months. We heard from Jennifer Dugan of the Minnesota Department of Education on Minnesota assessments. We heard from Dave Heistad on pathways to post-secondary mandated student achievement assessments in Minnesota. We heard from the commissioner redesigning transition from secondary to post-secondary education. The report put together by the commissioner, Larry Pogemiller, and Steve Rosenstone, and their 4-point vision for Minnesota. We heard from the Moundsview schools, which I think is a great model in terms of what they're doing and how this legislation, when it actually is in place, can look. And we also heard in regard to the assessment accountability for college and career readiness recommendations. You know, you all have a copy of that working group's report, and if I just highlight a couple of things, and then we'll probably just go over the bill. I think we can get that done in the next 15 minutes. The recommendations included things like assessments should be transparent, provide timely results. They should be aligned from elementary through high school, consistent with our standards, Minnesota standards. Minnesota should eliminate the Minnesota grad in writing, reading, and math, and the corresponding rules governing the grad assessments. And Minnesota should not replace the grad with another high-stakes graduation exam. Students who are not on track with nationally normed benchmark scores for college and career readiness should take a nationally normed diagnostic college placement exam or some other nationally normed diagnostic college placement exam upon completion of targeted interventions. And a career interest inventory should be administered as well. So a number of great recommendations, and I believe that this this legislation before you addresses many of those things. So we ask a lot of our tests. We do a lot of testing, too much testing, and I believe this bill will also streamline our testing procedures. We ask for school and systems accountability. We ask for students accountability. We look for college and workforce readiness, and soon a teacher performance will be related to the testing as well. So with that, I will ask the two testifiers with me to go over in as much plain English as they can. As we know, some of the language can be a little confusing, but we have Karen Hynek, Systems Director of College Transitions for MinSCU here. She was also a member of that task force. And then Matt Mose from St. Paul Public Schools, who was the co-chair of that particular task force as well. So I don't know how you've broken it down, but I'll turn it over to either one of you at this time.
Thank you. Senator, are you aware of any amendments Have you received any amendments? Because, you know, if you, we have four testifiers, so we could very well do this in the before we go into session. Do you have any amendments, members? Do you have any amendments?
Madam Chair, no one has come to me with any.
Yes, proceed with the testimony, and please be brief. I really appreciate that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Matthew Mose, the Chief Academic Officer for the St. Paul Public Schools. Just jump straight to the walkthrough. And before we go through a detailed walkthrough of the bill, I just want to give you an overview of what the legislation is intending to move us towards in terms of an assessment system. First off,
excuse me, could you please put the microphone closer to you so that we can hear it?
Madam Chair, is that better?
Yep, that's better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before I walk through the specifics of the legislation, it may be helpful for me to give you an outline of what's intended. As I spoke to you earlier in the session, the working group did recommend fairly definitively that the grad test should be eliminated and not replaced with any form of high-stakes graduation testing. In place of such a test, the recommendation was for the state to adopt a suite of assessments that could begin as early as eighth grade that provide measures on student progress towards college and career readiness with a career interest component built into it. On top of that, it was recommended that a series of diagnostic assessments be put in place for students who are not on track for college and career readiness and that are aligned to interventions that are acknowledged by both the K-12 system and post-secondary institutions. And then a third recommendation was for the state to modify its existing elementary and middle school testing to be fully computer adaptive to provide for more information useful for instruction and intervention. My colleague, Dr. Hynek, is going to be able to provide you with more background on the alignment between secondary and post-secondary, but we will get to that in a little bit. And so just to go through the bill so that everyone's on the same page, Section 1 began with we took a look at Senator Nelson's recommendation to go back to her legislation, and this makes a slight adjustment to actually making the requirement for career planning to be required starting next school year as opposed to optional. If the goal of college and career readiness is truly going to get put in place, it should be an expectation for all districts. Section 2, starting at page 2.31, is also addressing the transition. So these two sections we had to address because there are going to be a series of students who are caught in between. The new system is going to take a few years to get up and running, and we have students currently in high school, so we had to figure out how do we achieve this goal in absence of the grad. So one was the requirement for the career planning, and two is to clarify that the state can pay for the Explorer in grade 8 or 9. Because this is going to take effect with this year's eighth graders, there are some districts that have not chosen to administer the Explorer in eighth grade, and they'll need to offer it in grade 9 to meet the requirements of Section 1. And then it also allows for the commissioner to offer an ACT administration in 12th grade, and that would be a temporary measure to allow for the college entrance test requirement to be addressed in the transition until the suite of assessments is up and running. Section 3, which begins at 3.26 in subdivision 1, authorizes the commissioner to offer fully computer adaptive assessments. It eliminates obsolete language regarding the BST since that had been repealed a while ago. It addresses the requirement for students who have not yet passed the grad by the end of this school year by requiring a college entrance test, which was referred to in Section 2. And in Section C in 4.24 eliminates the grad and replaces it with the authority for a new suite of assessments. Starting at 5.24 through 6.17, the language replaces the old expectations for high school graduations with the new expectations aligned to college and career readiness. 6.18 through 6.25 eliminates unnecessary language on the alternate pathway since the grad will no longer exist under the proposal. 6.26 authorizes the suite of assessments. 7.6 deals with the career exploration component. 7.17 is about the college entrance test requirement for students who are on track at the end of grade, by the end of grade 10, and the expectation that they're encouraged to participate in our various college access programs like PSEO, concurrent enrollment, APIB, and such. In 7.26, for students who are not on track, it authorizes a diagnostic assessment and the expectation that those students take the college entrance test in the suite of assessments in grade 12. In 7.33, it is defining college and career the college and career readiness for students who are not on track. And then 8.8 talks about the alignment with higher education and the and standards and the expectation that if needed, the commissioner seek approval from the feds for various waivers to have our system in place. 8.13 talks about the need for empirically establishing benchmarks. So that's essentially doing studies based on existing data to establish the benchmarks as opposed to just setting them in advance. 8.23 asks for the information to be recorded on a student's transcript. 8.30 asks that the 3 through 8 computer adaptive assessments provide for benchmarks that are predictive of college and career readiness so that the trajectory for college and career readiness can be measured throughout a student's history. 9.1 is information, something on clarifications. My notes, I was jotting this down. Look at it really quick. So, again, this is, again, addressing the various references to statewide testing and adding the computer adaptive language throughout. The 9.19 is adding the effective dates, and we recognize that it's quite ambitious. A 15-16 implementation year for the full system would be definitely a significant amount of work for the department to accomplish, and so that may need to be revisited, but we wanted to make sure that the time that it's a close enough timeline. Section 4, beginning at 9.24, deals with various definitions in the bill. 10.9 deals with the language authorizing the computer adaptive tests in grades 3 through 8 and the characteristics of those tests. Section 5 at 11.32 talks about the various reporting that the department does and changes it to just conform with what the department actually does. And it also adds information about college and career readiness benchmarks and the percentage of students who achieve those. 12.27, Section 6, provides for information about the standard high school diploma for adults, for students who have left the system without a high school diploma and are trying to come back and get a traditional diploma. Section 7 at 13.10 addresses transition language and about the dates for effectiveness. Section 8 was the task force. They got removed with the Second Amendment to the bill. And 15.2, Section 9, is the repealer language that gets rid of the obsolete rule language that's still on the books for the BSTs and also repeals the rules for the grad. Think that should come.
Senator, is the repealer the appendix that we have here, right? So that members can have a reference. Senator, yes.
Just a clarification, Madam Chair, and I know you saw the standard high school diploma for adults. That is a separately moving bill as well, but just to give you an idea of how all-encompassing the discussion was in our committee, our working group, I should say, and trying to make sure every area is addressed, but I know that is moving, I think, Senator Claussen, with a task force attached to his, but that is also moving separately. So,
Senator, I have to tell you, I am so thankful for all the time that you invested into this. I know that Senator Clausen and Senator Kent have been participating with you, but I know that you have spent so many hours, and it has been incredibly helpful to this committee, because a lot of these recommendations were very complex, and we needed to hear from so many people. That was really the intent here, to try to form the working committees. Senator Wicklund, I applaud your effort as well with the childcare, early childhood effort. I know that it has not been a simple task to come up with these recommendations and read all of these materials that you had to read in order to make sense out of those recommendations and bring it into a policy recommendation. So I really appreciate it. We have one more testifier, members, and if we could give her that time, and then we would proceed with questions, unless you have a question of this particular testifier.
Yes, Madam. Chamberlain. Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. We only have a few minutes, and just quickly, I just want to clarify one thing. Two things is that the working committees, while laudable and well-intended, we only had one meeting, or I was only able to attend one meeting, so I can speak for myself. I know Senator Nino is not here, but he expressed the same thing. There were no recommendations, or I didn't see a bill. Senator Nino didn't see a bill out of the working committee. So they were really a non-entity, but a good and well-intended. Clarify this for me. Does this thing so we're removing the benchmarks for graduation, right? So I support the idea of streamlining the test, ACT, streamlining that through. But it appears to me we're going to say we are not going to measure what you've done K-12. Are we taking out what was put in 10 years ago? Is that what we're doing here? We're taking out the graduation requirements like we did for math? Thank you. I'm done.
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Chamberlain. The current system is just not working. That message came loud and clear from my colleagues in the schools, from the counselors, from the superintendents, and clearly by a 26-2 vote in the task force that it is absolutely not working. It's too fatalistic. It's not futuristic. I think the system that, and again, I thank you for thanking me for time, but it was really the people like that's sitting next to me that really put in the hours since the working group in really figuring out what is going to work. And I believe that when we consider what we're doing in our schools, yes, this does eliminate a cut score, but they might address the problems that the cut score has created. I think what we're putting in place is much better than this fatalistic cut score that looks backwards, not forward, and that's really what we're trying to accomplish here.
One follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
You say that it's fatalistic, that's fine, but we're always looking for outcomes, and I can support outcomes. Well, we have data here that shows that from 2008 to 2012, Senator Peterson has it too, he might want to comment on this, from 8 to 12, the scores for blacks in the schools for reading and writing improved by 15% and 11% over that 4 years, respectively. So we need some reform, but the process that was put in place some time ago now was having some impact on the achievement gap, and now we're saying we want to remove that. So I'm a little puzzled.
Senators, you know, there are many people who have been waiting here for 3 hours, and I think that I would like to give them the courtesy of testimony. However, we have session in 2 minutes. So issue that is clear, you know, this bill will be layover, so we will hear it again, because it will be part of, you know, the presentation that we have on the several policies that are coming together. So if you don't mind, I would like to proceed with the testifier that is at the table. I don't know if your other testifiers are here, Senator Dahl. I think that
Madam
you
Chair,
have-
they are, and, you know, if they see the need to testify, we can do that. But I do want to let Karen Hynek testify at this time. We can go from there.
Okay. Mr. Hynek, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow committee members, for the opportunity to testify before you on the merits of this proposed historic bill. The reality is this bill is an opportunity to be quite comprehensive with the vast education systems that we have in this state, including adult basic education, K-12, and higher education. I'm going to try to be brief and very clear and transparent. As a member of the Minnesota Department of Education's Assessment Committee and also the System Director of P20 and College Readiness for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, what you have before you is a plan that really outlines the 4 points that Commissioner Caselius, Chancellor Rosenstone, and Executive Director Pogemiller have been talking about for the last 18 months. How can we, in the economy that we're currently looking at, where studies show that 70% of the workforce by 2018 here in Minnesota will require some form of post-secondary education. Yet today in our state, students and adults of working age, we have about 40% that have post-secondary credentials. How do we move to a system that's more comprehensive and more able to help more students get post-secondary education? That's through collaboration. The 4-point plan really hinders on alignment of assessment, which is beginning with the end in mind. So it's looking at helping all students earlier on know what a college entrance exam is, be tested earlier to see whether they are on track and adopting a suite of assessments, whether it's ACT or SAT, doesn't really matter because both vendors do have the type of assessment suites where you can begin looking at career interest inventories as early as eighth grade, have predictive tests, and help students of all families decide whether or not they are on track to the benchmarks. There are lots of nationally normed exams like ACT and SAT that do actually have those types of benchmarks. When we know that students are actually on track, it's an opportunity to help all learners know about their opportunities for early college credit and being able to leverage whether it's PSEO, concurrent enrollment, IB, AP, articulated high school to college credit significantly earlier, and helping all learners, including underrepresented learners, learn more about those opportunities, which ultimately will accelerate their degree completion and make higher education affordable to them. On the converse side, if students are not on track, how do we help them earlier learn about the opportunities for targeted interventions while they're still in high school? Many of you are familiar with the Get Prepared report that comes out every 2 years. And the last time it came out in 2010, it talked about how 53% of the high school students from Minnesota went to a public university or state college. And of those students, 40% required some form of remediation. This proposed bill looks to address that and dramatically reduce remediation. By aligning assessment and using a placement diagnostic, we will know earlier students who are not on track. The reality is the evolution of testing in the last 3 to 5 years in higher education has allowed for diagnostic testing where you can actually find out which strands and subdomains a particular student is deficient in and then customize remediation based on what those students' actual needs are. And in this particular bill, it looks to having the Department of Education, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, as well as local school districts work together on determining how to create those targeted interventions while students are still in high school, and also for the MNSCU system to work with adult basic education to do the same thing, which ultimately helps our students across the continuum to receive remedial services while they're either in high school or through adult basic education, helping them not to have to use their financial aid dollars and time when they come to higher education needing remedial work. This is an important element to this particular bill because for the first time we could actually have targeted intervention statewide. We do have a lot of great local programs that our colleges and universities are piloting with local districts that show the possibility of such scale, whether it's the Jumpstart program with Minneapolis Community and Technical College, or it's Inver Hills Ladder program, or it's Central Lakes work on bridges. We see the pilots all across our state, but it's how do we create something that's more statewide. In addition to that, the opportunity to have every student have a post-secondary or career plan starting as early as eighth grade. A lot of literature on that particular piece, helping students and families actually learn about the labor market, learn about the types of post-secondary opportunities, and helping them to figure out, are they on track to meeting those pathways? Those are the core elements of this particular bill, and I thank you for allowing me to speak on it.
Thank you, Senator. We have to recess for session and afternoon, and we will reconvene at 5:30 at room 125.